You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
And so there we've seen very major shifts taking place within the Middle East and even in the broader Asian region, where countries are aligning with China and Russia and Iran to the detriment of their links with the United States and NATO, where Turkey is in a transitional period of asserting itself as a regional power. And all of this is upsetting historic geopolitical alignments, which were established since the end of World War II, and it's evolved right through the neocons. But we're in a very different world today.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Broader Global Crisis. Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Today we concentrate on the global crisis, North Korea, Qatar, Iran, Turkey, Russia, China, Venezuela, Cuba, and a major geopolitical shift taking place in Pakistan and India. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
Delighted to be on Guns and Butter.
You made a recent trip to South Korea. With all of the saber-rattling by the U.S. and North Korea, what did you learn about the Korean situation when you were there? To follow current events on Twitter and in the news, it reads like a reality TV show.
Well, maybe we should ask President Trump whether this is a reality TV show or whether he really means to press the button. But I should clarify a number of things. It is not Donald Trump that decides on the use of nuclear weapons. Why? And people are very confused in this regard. In 2001, under what is called the Nuclear Posture Review, the U.S. nuclear doctrine was overhauled, redefined, and a certain category of nuclear weapons, which were called tactical nuclear weapons or mini-nukes, were reclassified as conventional weapons. In other words, they could be used alongside other conventional weapons. And these mini-nukes, in fact, are not different from the strategic nuclear bombs of the Cold War era. They have some different characteristics. They have a lesser yield, but in fact, they go from one-third to six times the Hiroshima bomb, and I think there's some that are even more dangerous than that. But the very act of redefining these nuclear bombs as conventional weapons and giving them a label and saying, quote-unquote, they're harmless to the surrounding civilian population means that Donald Trump doesn't decide. It's a three-star general in the war theater, in the conventional war theater, who can, I'm not saying he will, but who can actually decide to use a tactical nuclear weapon. Most probably will coordinate with Strategic Command headquarters in Nebraska, but it is not for Trump to actually intervene. It's a Pentagon decision. And this was the object of a fair amount of debate in the Senate, including our Senator Dianne Feinstein, of Democrat of California. And at the time, that was actually, it was subsequent to the actual vote in 2002, 2003. But and then Senator Edward Kennedy at the time also made the point and said, you are, in fact, blurring the relationship between weapons of mass destruction and conventional weapons. And he was firmly opposed to this redefinition of nuclear bombs. And then what they introduced was the notion of the, and this is a military concept, the toolbox. Okay? Now, the toolbox is a box from which the military can choose, or the three-star general can go in and choose what he wants. And so that these mini-nukes, which are bunker buster bombs or nuclear warheads, were recategorized by the U.S. Senate, and they become bona fide conventional weapons. And we don't need to go and ask Donald Trump whether we can use them or not. Mad Dog Mattis will probably get the last word on that. And that's the guy who actually bombed the hell out of Fallujah during the Iraq War. Now, what I did learn from my trip to South Korea, there's a new president. The previous president was impeached. We hope there's a freeing of political prisoners. The new president is in favor of dialogue with the North, and this was crucial to our debate in South Korea. South Korea has a defense cooperation agreement, which in time of war puts the entire South Korean armed forces under the command of a three-star general appointed by the Pentagon. And since the armistice agreement of 1953 was never repealed by a peace agreement, that means that the United States is in a state of war against North Korea since 1950. There was a truce, but there was never a peace agreement. Now, people in America don't know, talking about security and so on, that up to 30% of the population of North Korea were killed as a result of U.S. bombings. More than 90% of cities were destroyed. Pyongyang was totally destroyed. And then we have to ask ourselves, and it's very important in assessing U.S. war plans in relation to North Korea, does a country which lost 30% of its population during a U.S.-led war in the 1950s constitute a threat to the United States of America? Or does the United States of America constitute a threat to the security of North Korea? There's not a single family who has not lost a loved one during that war. And then put yourself in the shoes of the North Koreans. What would happen, let's say, if a foreign country had bombed major cities, New York, Washington, Chicago, right to the ground, as they did in North Korea, and that there were close to 100 million people killed, one-third of the U.S. population. That is what happened. And it's not a question of accepting or denying that interpretation. The U.S. military actually acknowledged that they killed. They said, General Curtis LeMay, we must have killed 20%. He said 20% of the population of that country and destroyed every single city. Okay, the exact quote is there. So that is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a country which has been threatened for the last 67 years. We're dealing with a country which lost 30% of its population during the Korean War, which was totally destroyed. And the media is turning reality totally upside down and presenting North Korea as the aggressor because it has developed nuclear weapons as a means of deterrence. Whether that is something we support or not, I personally don't support it, but it was a choice that they made following almost persistent nuclear threats by the United States starting in 1950, the threat of nuclear war. So they've been living every single year. They run war games with scenarios of nuclear weapon attacks against North Korea. And this, of course, has created a response on the part of North Korea in developing their own nuclear arsenal.
In May 1951, after President Truman had relieved him of his command, General MacArthur testified to Congress that, quote, "The war in Korea has already almost destroyed that nation of 20 million people. I have never seen such devastation. I have seen, I guess, as much blood and disaster as any living man, and it just curdled my stomach the last time I was there. After I looked at that wreckage and those thousands of women and children and everything, I vomited. If you go on indefinitely, you are perpetrating slaughter such as I have never heard of in the history of mankind." That from General MacArthur. Now, isn't it also true that they devastated South Korea?
Well, they also devastated parts of South Korea, and there was a program of targeted assassinations in South Korea. And those war crimes actually, they were not an object of discussion within South Korea. And then just about, I think it was about 10 years ago, they opened the dossier, and the victims, the families of the victims started to speak out. It was something they couldn't do during the military governments that they had. But you see, the situation now in South Korea is that if we look at U.S. strategies, which is really to make other countries do the war for them, so to speak, like they're doing in Yemen, they mobilize Saudi Arabia to go and bomb Yemen. But with their joint defense agreement, they could trigger a war between North and South. So that agreement has to be rescinded. That was the object of our discussion in South Korea. But and at the same time now, the South Korean president says we're going to have dialogue. But the question is the issue of sanity within this reality TV type of environment. There's a certain sanity within South Korea as far as policymakers are concerned. They have said we want to talk to the North Koreans. After the impeachment of the daughter of General Park, Mrs. Park, there was the candlelight movement, and they want to enter into dialogue. Now, the United States is trying to block them from initiating a dialogue with the North. So if you ask what is the outcome of these fire and fury statements by President Trump, I would say we're at the crossroads of perhaps the most serious crisis in modern history, because a nuclear attack on North Korea, or even a conventional attack on North Korea, would escalate. And bear in mind, Trump doesn't have too much of a knowledge of geography. North Korea has borders with Russia and China and South Korea, and is in almost within swimming distance of Japan. So there you are. You've got these five countries there, Japan, North Korea, South Korea, China, and Russia. And it is very unlikely that the Russians and the Chinese would let things happen at their doorstep. And there's a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations at this time. But we're dealing with people who, first of all, don't understand the impacts of nuclear weapons. And I don't blame them for that, because if they read the military manuals, they'll say that tactical nuclear weapons are harmless to civilians. And I should say that the tactical nuclear weapon, just to show how absurd it is, had been contemplated during the Clinton administration against Libya. Okay, it was the first initiative in that regard. And then we had another situation where analysts said we should use nuclear weapons against Saddam Hussein, okay? Tactical nuclear weapons against Saddam Hussein. So that the whole discussion and debate on nuclear weapons is ultimately to give them a human face, say these are peacekeeping bombs. We can go after Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein in his bunker buster, drop a bunker buster bomb with a nuclear warhead, and so on and so forth. And ultimately, we have a president who may read these briefs, but at the same time, he doesn't have the critical mindset to understand that those briefs are fabricated. Okay, so we're feeding fake news to the United States president. It's what I would call internal propaganda. It is to create a consensus in favor of nuclear war within the realm of decision makers, and it transcends. It's within the State Department. It's in the U.S. Congress, and so on and so forth. And we've seen this unfolding. They have seminars for top officials and so on. So that the lies to the public are one thing, but they are lies within the decision-making apparatus, which ultimately incite those decision-makers to conform to a consensus. And the consensus which is building up now, apart from the Russiagate thing, is that, as far as nuclear weapons are concerned, is that they are just one among many other forms of military intervention. And that we can now, and that's where the doctrine of preemptive warfare came in. It's not only preemptive warfare in conventional terms, it's preemptive warfare using first strike nuclear weapon for defensive purposes, which is a very skewed type of argument. We're going to defend ourselves by blowing up a country which allegedly threatens us. So far, North Korea is not threatening the United States. They've only said that they would target one of their ICBMs and land a bomb close to Guam, but within at least 20 or 30 miles of Guam in the ocean. That's the only thing they've said. They're not threatening the United States. They're saying, well, if you threaten us and you want to attack us, we have the ability to respond. And I think that is something which people have to take into account.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosudovsky. Today's show, The Broader Global Crisis. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
First of all, the United States has refused to sign a peace treaty, but they have also refused to acknowledge the reunification of North and South Korea. And the reason that they have blocked the reunification is that if that reunification were to occur, Korea, a unified Korea, would constitute a regional power which would be sovereign in relation to the United States of America. Now, there is, within South Korea, there's a strong movement towards reunification. There's also a movement against the departure of U.S. troops. There's also a movement against rescinding the Joint Defense Cooperation Agreement, which puts really all South Korean troops under U.S. command in case of war. But by definition, they're at war since 1950 because there was never a peace agreement. But I think ultimately the United States foreign policy is to ensure that independent countries do not become competing powers or competing regional powers. And if you combine the high-tech industries of South Korea in quite a number of areas, automotive, electronics, and so on. It's a highly developed industrial high-tech economy, and with export capabilities, of course, Korean cars all over the place. And you combine that with the science and technology and military technologies of North Korea, and a larger, substantially larger population, there what you will have is a regional power which will eventually contribute to upsetting the geopolitical balance within Northeast Asia to the detriment of the United States. It may also at the same time change the relationship between Japan and the United States, and that those two countries also have a joint military cooperation agreement. So I think ultimately also what Washington wants is to prevent the reunification of the two Koreas, because this would create a competing world power with military capabilities, high-tech industry, and so on, which would challenge the hegemony of the United States in Northeast Asia.
Three Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, and Egypt, cut ties with Qatar and imposed a land, sea, and air blockade that is now entering its third month. You've recently returned from a trip to Qatar. What did you learn there of the ongoing crisis? How and why did the political shift against Qatar begin?
Well, there's a certain complexity there, but there's one important dimension, which is the fact that Qatar has a long-standing relationship with Iran in the area of natural gas. And the Persian Gulf has, between the two countries, Iran on one side, Qatar on the other, those reserves are the largest reserves of natural gas worldwide. They're sitting on a gold mine. And the fact of the matter is that while Qatar has links with a lot of oil companies, Western oil companies, those gas fields are jointly owned by Iran and Qatar in an agreement between the respective governments. And it's not simply a question of saying this part belongs to me and that part belongs to you. It's a joint ownership and joint cooperation. So that, I think, is fundamental. In turn, Qatar has established links with Russia in the gas industry. It also invested indirectly in one of Russia's energy conglomerates, Rosneft. There are lots of Russians and Chinese in the oil industry. And there are, of course, pipelines. Now, when you look at strategic pipelines for natural gas, a lot of that natural gas actually is exported by tanker, but they're now developing the gas pipelines. And since Saudi Arabia has come in and closed the border, what happened is there's been a sort of a major realignment. They closed the border. All the ground trade which was coming into the country came through Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And so that Qatar all of a sudden is isolated, transformed de facto into an island rather than a peninsula. And who comes to the rescue? Iran, with large shipments of basic food commodities, which previously came through Saudi Arabia. And also Turkey is involved. Turkey is also helping them. Now, it just so happens that with the closure of the border with Saudi Arabia, Qatar is now contemplating to export its natural gas through Iran and through Turkey, and that is occurring as opposed to the pipeline route which united Qatar with Saudi Arabia, which goes from Qatar through Saudi Arabia into Jordan and then into the Mediterranean. Okay, so now the pipeline routes have changed, the geopolitics have shifted, and at the same time, there's some very fundamental contradictions, because whereas Qatar now is aligned with enemies of the United States of America, namely Iran, but also China and Russia, the United States has its largest military base in Qatar. It's an Air Force base, and if I'm not mistaken, it's also the headquarters of Central Command, so that the U.S. is an ally of Saudi Arabia. It has a major military facility in Qatar. But the country is allied with Iran as far as its energy resources are concerned. And then in turn, more recently, Turkey has come in and wants to have its own military base in Qatar. So this is leading to a sort of a geopolitical crisis. Turkey is present in Qatar. Iran is present. The United States have a military base. Saudi Arabia has cut its borders. the pipeline routes have been redirected. And then the question is, how is this going to evolve? How is it going to evolve with a U.S. military facility in a country which has cleavages with enemies of America, essentially Iran and then Russia and China, all of which are in the gas industry, with China being a major importer? There's still, of course, Western companies are there. They have contracts in the oil and gas industry. That's nothing new. But the encroachment of Iran is absolutely fundamental. Now, there's another important shift which is taking place. It's a geopolitical shift. It's the role of Turkey, and it's the relationship between Turkey and the United States on the one hand, and Turkey and its relationship to Iran and Russia. And that has to do with northern Syria, where the United States is pushing for the creation of a Kurdistan proxy state or protectorate that's in northern Syria, which would be annexed, which would secede from Syria. This fighting is still ongoing, and the project is eventually to integrate that with the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Now, that's a U.S. project. Turkey has another project because, of course, they have been fighting the Kurdish project for generations. But the notion, the project that the United States would establish a Kurdistan region was already envisaged even back in the late 90s, where portions of Iraq and Syria, as well as Turkey, would form the new Kurdistan region. And now, as a result of that, there's been a sort of a clash between Turkey and the United States, to the extent that Turkey has recently acquired the S-300 air defense system from Russia. Now, how does that fit in when we know, first of all, that Turkey is a heavyweight in NATO, and when we know that the air defense system of NATO member countries is under NATO standards and it's using Western and U.S. technology and not the technology of the Russian Federation? So there you have a member of NATO, heavyweight of NATO, which has purchased its air defense system from Russia, which is on the U.S.-NATO hit list, and which is also collaborating with Iran with regard to pipeline routes, you know, from the Iranian Persian Gulf coast, but also from Qatar, Iran, Turkey, Turkey Mediterranean. So there we are. We have a very complex situation evolving. And I wouldn't exclude the possibility that at some future date there would be some kind of military, either a military intervention or, which is more likely, some kind of regime change taking place in Qatar, of which the intent would be to destabilize the country's relationship with Iran primarily, but also with Russia and China. Qatar is not a big country. It's a population of 2.2 million. Most of that population are made up of foreign workers. And the military intervention by, e.g., by Saudi Arabia is not something which can be excluded. But it's a very, very unstable situation, and it marks some major realignments, you know, on the Middle East chessboard.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Broader Global Crisis. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And then in turn, if we look at broader relations between Iran, let's say Iran, Pakistan, India, very recently, that was about a month and a half ago, I believe in late June, India and Pakistan join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and in fact, on the same day. And we know that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is essentially an alliance between Moscow and Beijing, with several former Soviet republics, observer members. But it signifies something which is pretty fundamental. Well, Pakistan is already aligned with China, and that's very significant because Pakistan was a staunch ally of the United States. But economically speaking, it is aligned with China, and India. The situation with regard to India is not clear. But what was very significant at that meeting of the SCO is that the SCO demanded that full members of the SCO would resolve their border differences in a peaceful fashion. And that was addressed to Pakistan and India. And what I think is certainly possible is that this creates a new environment. It's not the old-fashioned situation of Pakistan and India fighting for territories in Kashmir, which is essentially the legacy of the British colonial apparatus. And now there's a new era of U.S.-Pakistan relations. You know, that conflict, Pak-India conflict, has been nurtured by Washington since the Cold War era. And now you have a situation where these two countries, Pakistan and India, are members of essentially an alliance of two competing superpowers, namely China and Russia. And despite the fact that the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement has been presented as a Eurasian economic, political, and mutual security organization, it doesn't exclude the fact that it is also tacitly a military alliance, and it serves geopolitical and strategic interests. It's so to speak a counterweight to U.S. NATO. And so there we've seen very major shifts taking place within the Middle East and even in the broader Asian region, where countries are aligning with China and Russia and Iran, to the detriment of their links with the United States and NATO, where Turkey is in a transitional period of asserting itself as a regional power, okay, the Ottoman project of President Erdogan. And all of this is upsetting historic geopolitical alignments, which were established, let's say, since the end of World War II. It's referred to the Truman Doctrine, George Kennan, and it's evolved right through the neocons. But we're in a very different world today. But at the same time, we're in an extremely dangerous crossroads, largely because of the reality TV nature of U.S. foreign policy.
With regard to the blockade of Qatar, isn't a blockade considered an act of war? Turkey and Qatar completed Iron Shield war games, or joint military exercises, in Doha. This seems very serious to me.
Well, it certainly is, because it points to shifting alliances, what we might call cross-cutting coalitions. We are in that era of cross-cutting coalitions. Qatar and Turkey have established alliance now against the United States and Saudi Arabia, okay? But at the same time, well, maybe not explicitly or officially, but at the same time, both Turkey is an ally of the United States, and Qatar has the largest military base in the Middle East, right, sitting, within 100 kilometers of Doha. So it's a very contradictory relationship. I'm referring back to the map of the new Middle East, which was established by a member of the U.S. military. It was meant for academic purposes, but it shows, and that map goes back to the 1990s. It shows a situation where part of Turkey has been annexed by what the you know, what the map calls Free Kurdistan. It's a Pentagon map or military academy map. And Free Kurdistan includes part of northern Iraq and then part of Syria. And then you have another situation where there's Free Baluchistan. And Baluchistan is part of Iran and part of Pakistan and so on. So that they've certainly been redrawing the map. But at the same time, these various countries of the Middle East and beyond have been very astutely establishing bilateral agreements and alliances. The Russians have been extremely sophisticated in that regard. They establish bilateral relations with every single ally of the United States. Okay, so they have an alliance now with Turkey, which is a very significant alliance, and that was after, if we recall, earlier on in the war in Syria, when Turkey started blowing up Russian planes. But now there's a tacit alliance between Turkey and Russia, which includes the delivery of the S-300 air defense system to Turkey. And then there's a rapprochement between Turkey and Iran. Of course, Turkey and Iran were members of the peace conferences in Astana. And we know that Turkey and Iran historically hate each other's guts. But nonetheless, now they're prepared to negotiate, because their pipeline routes, and both Iran and Turkey consider themselves as regional powers, and justifiably they are regional powers. So if you look at the situation in Venezuela, Venezuela now has the largest oil reserves in the world. A large part of them are tar sands, but they're less costly than tar sands in Alberta. But that's very important. Venezuela has the largest oil reserves worldwide.
No wonder that what's happening in Venezuela is happening.
Yeah, I know the stakes are extremely high, extremely high. They're much higher than they are, let's say, in Syria. But it's also the fact that whatever happens in Venezuela is going to affect the entire continent. It's going to break down whatever trade and solidarity agreements existed between Latin American countries. It's going to affect immediately Bolivia, Ecuador, and certainly also Cuba. And it has already, in a sense, there's already been a breakdown in the relations between Cuba and Venezuela. And that's something I witnessed when I was in Havana a couple of years back. Because, to put it bluntly, the same foundations which are funding the opposition in Venezuela are also funding intellectuals in Cuba. I'm talking about the Hans Seidel Foundation, which is linked up to the Bavarian Christian Democratic Party. It's more or less the right wing of Angela Merkel. Well, they, in 2012... were behind Capriles Radonsky, who was running against Chavez. Chavez won those elections, but they were involved in funding the opposition candidate. That's the Hans Seidel Foundation. Now, it just so happens that the Hans Seidel Foundation is also active in Cuba. And the event that I went to, which was a debate on transition, political transition, Cuba, etc., normalization, was funded by the Hans Seidel Foundation. And it just so happened that there was a session of Venezuela, but there was not a single person from Venezuela who was invited, not a single intellectual. And this was a think tank and a research entity which was associated with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And then what did they do? They invited an Israeli guy who started comparing the Palestinians to Al-Qaeda. And then they had people from Austria and the European Parliament who were discussing the issues pertaining to Ukraine and support of Maidan. And nobody in the audience of these Cuban researchers actually contested these various points of view. There was an Iranian there who did actually speak out, and there was myself. But there we are in socialist Cuba, and we have a Zionist from Chatham House Royal Institute of International Affairs, pretty mediocre as a scholar, who comes in and starts talking about Syria and accusing Bashar al-Assad of killing his own people and so on, when in fact the Cuban leadership had actually taken a stance on Syria, okay? Fidel Castro had taken a stance on Syria. So those are the kinds of things which are, of course, relevant, because if Cuba and Venezuela don't stick together, they'll be decimated by Washington.
Well, who sponsored this conference in Cuba?
No, the conference in Cuba was under the auspices of the Center for Research on International Politics, so to speak. It's one of the main research institutes which is attached to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And in fact, it was under the auspices, really, of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that this conference took place. I should say, you have a research institute which is independent of the government agencies, but it nonetheless advises the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs finances it. And so they organized this conference. They got the funding from Hans Seidel. Now, Hans Seidel has a very black history, because they also supported in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, they were supporting the transition governments in Ukraine. They were also involved in Chile. You can look at the track record. I've written this up in an article. But the fact of the matter is that while the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, cannot set foot in Cuba, the various European counterparts, particularly from Germany, they have offices there, and they are involved in the same mechanism of co-optation. And given the fact that Cuba has a dual currency system, any payment in convertible currency is a gold mine for the people who are receiving those honoraria.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Broader Global Crisis. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And what happened to me when I was invited to this conference, I got a note from the foundation, the Hans Seidel Foundation, and they said, we're contacting you to pay your expenses and to establish a contract and discuss honoraria, okay? That's what happened. And I then contacted the organizers in Havana and said, I don't need the support of the Hans Seidel Foundation. I will be paying my own expenses. And I went to that conference and paid my own expenses, air travel. It created havoc because I somehow didn't fit into the lists that they had established and the hotel reservations which had been made by the German Foundation on their behalf. But that was a personal experience, but it also provided me with an understanding of what was going on in Cuba. I don't see a transition which will actually protect the achievements of the Cuban Revolution. I see exactly the opposite. That's despite the fact that, broadly the Cuban people are committed to the achievements of the Cuban Revolution, but at the same time, the mechanisms which have been set in place, dual currency system, and the funding of research by foreign foundations, it doesn't really look good. And the situation, for instance, I met up with colleagues from the universities, and this is, I would say, relatively recent. They said, well, we make our salary in U.S. dollars is less than $20 a month, okay? Now, the taxi driver will make $25 just in the ride from the airport to the hotel. And there it is. It's a monthly salary. Now, it's not to say that people are impoverished, abysmally impoverished, because they still have the safety nets of the Cuban Revolution, which are, the system of ration, of essential commodities that they receive, the housing which is provided to them and so on and so forth. But very significant social divisions are occurring between those who are paid in local currency and those who are paid in convertible currency. It's not the U.S. dollar. It's called the Cook, and it means essentially convertible currency unit. Okay, so that's the context in Cuba at the moment, I'm not very optimistic as to the outcome. On the other hand, what I sense in Venezuela is that certainly there's a regime change strategy which has certain features of what happened in Ukraine with Maidan. Rooftop people shooting at demonstrators and killing them and so on. That is certainly there. So that, in effect, the foreign policy consultants on behalf of Washington are applying the same kinds of procedures that they applied in other countries. But then there's another dimension, which is reminiscent of the last months of the Chilean Popular Unity government under Salvador Allende. I recall those events because I lived through them. I was there during the coup. And what happened is that there was a dual currency system, okay? There were dollars, and then there were escudos, and then there was hyperinflation, and there was a problem of distribution of essential commodities which had been engineered by corporations, local businesses, with the support, most probably with the support of U.S. intelligence. Of course, there was Henry Kissinger as well. But this dual currency system ultimately, plus the collapse in the standard of living, which is attributable to the scarcity of commodities or massive inflation, which is beyond the control of the monetary authorities, that is what struck me as bearing a similarity to the last months in Chile, leading up to the coup on 11th of September 1973, so that there's a process of destabilization of the monetary system on the one hand, and then there's also an issue of distribution of goods and services, an impoverishment of the population through the manipulation of markets and distribution. And then on the other hand, there's, you know, the regime change manipulated protest movements with snipers on rooftops, killing people, and then blaming the government. I mean, this notion of blaming the government, we find it in several countries. We saw it in Ukraine, where the Maidan incidents were blamed on the government, which was deposed, or Yanukovych. And we see, of course, the whole narrative of blaming Bashar al-Assad for killing his own people. So that is the kind of discourse and narrative you'll get in the media, without bearing in mind that, first of all, one has to look a bit at the history. Venezuela was really a puppet regime up until Chavez. Okay, Juan Vicente Gomez was the dictator from the early period of the oil boom. Of course, then with several government changes, then you had Perez Jimenez, and then subsequently the two major parties, COPE and ADECO, came in, and that was in the 60s. But today, Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world. Okay, that issue is never mentioned. It's admittedly a large part of those reserves are tar sands. The cost of developing them are much higher, but the tar sands in Venezuela are more cost-effective than those in Canada. But that makes certainly Venezuela is strategic, and the fact that the Western oil companies were penalized by the Chavez government is something that they are not going to forget very easily, and that's precisely why Chavez was in all likelihood assassinated, and that was their plan eventually, to assassinate the leader and then move into a regime change scenario characterized by financial destabilization with exchange rates, prices of essential commodities, coupled with the covert forms of intervention, painkillers on the rooftops, shooting at demonstrators, and so on and so forth. Infiltration into the armed forces as well. Infiltration into the armed forces. Because Chavez's essential support, which strengthened his government, was the fact that he had the support of the armed forces, which is not always the case in Latin American countries.
Well, how does a dual currency situation, so you've mentioned this dual currency situation both with regard to Cuba and Venezuela, how does that get started?
It starts, it's been ongoing for quite a number of years. It didn't necessarily start, in the context of the protest movement. In Venezuela, the black market has been there. And people come to accept it, you know. I recall also that in Chile, even there was a black market right from the outset of the Popular Unity government. And I think, in part, it's the inability of the authorities to implement a coherent exchange rate policy. In countries like Venezuela, where the central bank is very much related to the commercial banking system, which is still controlled by Venezuelan conglomerates. Okay, there's a lot of money in Venezuela owned by the elites and so on. So that the banking system is private. Now there was a project of actually nationalizing the banks, but the thing is, you don't really have in Venezuela people within the central bank who are capable or willing to actually resolve this issue of dual currency. The black market, the dollar versus the bolivar in the case of Venezuela, and there's a lot of corruption which surrounds that relationship. Okay, and now we have a situation where they import commodities from the world market, and then they're supposed to be sold in local currency at government prices, and they never reach the points of distribution at government prices. They're immediately sent off and sold on the black market, because the price between, let's say you can buy certain essential commodities at the government price in local currency, but you can also buy them at ridiculously high prices in local currency in the free market, so that those prices are dollarized, okay? And people who have dollars, of course, are very well-to-do, and people who don't have to deal with very exceedingly low salaries. So that essentially what has happened in Venezuela is that people have been impoverished through this process of financial manipulation, which I think is instrumented both by actors within the country as well as the integration of Venezuela's banking system into the world financial system, and the impacts are devastating. Now, one area which was very crucial in Venezuela was also the manipulation of the price of crude oil on the international commodity markets. We know that took place. These were engineered actions in the commodity markets, in the energy markets, to push the price down. After having pushed it up to more than 100 and something, and then it was pushed down, and in many regards it was pushed down below the cost of production of oil in the tar sands, for instance. And Canada was also heavily affected by this. But that movement in the oil price was very much detrimental to Venezuela, and it was engineered and it was intended. It went against Venezuela. It went against all major oil producers, but it was essentially targeted against Venezuela, and it was also targeted against Iran and Russia.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Delighted to have this discussion.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been The Broader Global Crisis. Michel Chosadovsky is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, The Globalization of War, and America's Long War Against Humanity. Visit globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call for all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit snipers trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look within inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, it's Potpourri number 6, featuring Noam Chomsky, our eccentric press review, and a little music in between. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's another Potpourri show, Potpourri number 6. Potpourri is an old French word. It means a bunch of fragrant herbs bound together. Speaking of bondage, don't miss our press review story of a dominatrix who went too far. More on that later. Anyway, potpourri is useful in warding off bubonic plague infection, also in camouflaging body odor. Running water plumbing and daily bathing were invented long after potpourri was. Be that as it may, today we offer potpourri number 6, a bit of this, a bit of that, and a good helping of Noam Chomsky talking to Ralph Nader on Chomsky's recent book and film, Requiem for the American Dream. Plus some music by Ethan Miller and Kate Boverman, and a brief press review. Let's begin with the press review. Fanfare, please. We'll start out with an item from my local rag, the Journal Enquirer of No Fixed Address. It's a column by consumer affairs columnist Harlan Levy. Its title is What Climate Change Will Mean for Consumers. And it's based on Levy's interview with Manchester conservation scientist Kip Kolesinskas. Sidebar comment, have you noticed the old switcheroo established power pulled on the issue of climate change? First, they essentially denied climate change, presented it as just a controversial conspiracy theory. Then they suddenly accepted it with a fatalistic shrug. Nothing you can do about it. Just be cautious when investing in shorefront properties. Your investment may lose value in 20 years when your shorefront property is underwater. So the establishment, including the corporate media, jumped directly from climate change is unproven to, well, it's too late to do anything about it. There was never an in-between stage where they said, climate change is a crisis and we've got to do something to head it off. Thanks, guys. But I'm not blaming the Journal Enquirer's consumer affairs columnist for all the failures of the corporate media. Actually, I like Harlan Levy's column. I'll just note that it falls right in with the media's new nothing you can do about it perspective. The title of the column is What Climate Change Will Mean for Consumers, and I will paraphrase. Citing conservation scientist Kip Kolesinskas. In Connecticut, Kolesinskas says, expect more hotter days, fewer cold days, less snow, more rain, rising sea levels, an increasing freeze-free season, and much less predictability. Here are some of the specific effects on the state's consumers. Flooding. Connecticut is getting wetter. Precipitation events will be larger and quicker, making flooded basements and flooded septic systems more likely and more severe. The flooding will also affect sewage treatment plants. Here is another: significant snowstorms in the early fall and late spring because of more unpredictable jet stream fluctuations. The brief but heavier snowfalls will tax roofs, decks, and greenhouses, he predicts. Effect number 3, higher taxes. Municipalities will have to spend more on weather disasters and related emergencies, and will have to spend more rebuilding infrastructure. Recreation. With less snowfall and fewer winter days, the viability of Connecticut's ski industry will be threatened. Here is another effect. More and new pests. Fewer days with snow cover mean many insects will survive winter and lay eggs more often. Raising crops and gardening will entail dealing with more pests, some new to the area. Kolosinskis says even a few degrees difference can mean mosquitoes, including those carrying West Nile and Zika viruses. Mosquitoes will survive winters here and pose disease threats. Here's another effect. More warm season local crops. There will be more melons, grapes, and tomatoes, but fewer sugar maples. Another effect will be imported seasonal foods to eat will be fewer and at higher prices, including fewer fruits and vegetables. In 2016, there were fewer peaches and nectarines, Kolosinskis said, because of a warm winter followed by a very cold period when plants were waking up in the spring. There may be less spinach and greens. One effect, at least temporarily, will be more and cheaper beef. When there's a drought in the West, farmers slaughter their beef cattle rather than paying what it would cost to feed and graze them. Because of that, the market will be temporarily flooded with beef, thus lowering the price, though eventually the price will rise again. Here's another effect, more acidification of ocean water, which absorbs more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. That affects creatures' ability to form shells. That imperils the oyster and clam industry. Warming waters have already affected the lobster industry in Long Island Sound. Okay, thanks to Harlan Levy for that synopsis of how global climate change will affect consumers in the near term in Connecticut. And now a couple short items. Let me see. There was a late-night fire at a fire station in Concord, Massachusetts. Firefighters could not reach their firefighting equipment, so they ran out the back door and telephoned the main station for help. Two fire trucks and an ambulance were damaged in the blaze. Story number three might be titled, Too Much of a Good Thing. Police in Waterbury, Connecticut, have charged a dominatrix with extortion, voyeurism, and malice. After abusing, humiliating, whipping, and spanking her paying client, I don't actually know what exactly she did, I'm just imagining some details here. Whatever, after giving the customer $250 worth of sexual abuse, domination, and humiliation, she tossed in some blackmail for free, charging him $5,000 not to release a video she had made of their encounter. After paying half that sum, the man went to the police. And that's all the news that's fit to print in this edition of Press Review. We'll have more one of these days. Noam Chomsky returns in conversation with Ralph Nader on the new concentration of wealth in America and its dire effects on everybody else. To get us warmed up for that, how about a song on capitalism by Ethan Miller and Kate Boverman?
You got a penthouse in the city and another home in the hills. You got a corner office on the 51st floor and you walk on a carpet made of $100 bills. Well, I look at you up there in your plush office chair and I wonder what is going through your brain. As you look outside your window, watch the people moving by below. Thinking about your capital gains. Now you look me in the eye and tell me exactly what it is you do. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that you make your money from the groovy work that other people do. Well, that's living a way. sipping your coffee on Madison Avenue. Should I call you evil? Should I call you cruel? Did you just come from the right family and go to all the right schools? Tell me, what do you think of your life? Does it feed your soul? Sometimes blame is just like honey, gets all over everything, and it's never enough to be careful what you buy when you're shopping. In a land known for democracy, it's amazing how it comes to be. Freedom is the choice between Coke and Pepsi. So tell me your free markets will satisfy our needs. Don't tell me that what's good for Monsanto is good for me. You rob us of our livelihoods and our grandmother's seeds.
Last winter, Ralph Nader interviewed Noam Chomsky on the occasion of Chomsky's new book and Netflix video, Requiem for the American Dream. We heard part of the conversation on a show 3 months ago. Let's hear some more now. Chomsky discusses these strategies of the wealthy elite to consolidate and increase their own wealth and power. The strategies are: institute neoliberal programs, shift the burden, attack solidarity, and control the regulators. Here's Noam Chomsky.
So if you go back to the 50s and 60s, the period of what's sometimes called regulated capitalism, great growth period, banks were banks. Banks were places where you could deposit some money. They would lend it to somebody for, say, starting a business or building a home or whatever. That's what banks were. They were also regulated by the New Deal regulations, so there were no financial crises. Starting in the early 70s, that changed radically. All of this was coordinated, and one of the results was that financial institutions not only grew enormously in size, just exploded, but also changed radically in character. Instead of being connected to the real economy, they more and more were involved in speculation, that complicated the financial instruments, all the things we've seen. And of course, the deregulation began late Carter, but particularly Reagan and Clinton. Deregulation meant regular financial crises, financial crisis means the public bails out the big banks for their predatory activities. We saw this again in 2007-2008. The effects of all these policies, we'll just talk to the United States, about the United States, but it's quite similar elsewhere. The effect of these policies was to increase sharply the concentration of capital. The wealth became extremely concentrated. For the general public, there was stagnation or even decline. That's simply, to take one illustration, just take real wages of working people, non-supervisory workers. In 2007, that's right before the great crash, that's the peak of euphoria among economists, political analysts, and so on, about the wonderful economy that we have. It was called the Great Moderation. Everything's been solved, and so on. So right at that point, 2007, real wages for working people were lower than they were in 1979 when the neoliberal policies began. And that's an index of what's happened. Well, one effect of concentration of wealth is that you get concentration of political power by obvious mechanisms, which means kind of a vicious cycle sets off in which a political power being concentrated makes decisions which lead further to further concentration of wealth and undermine popular participation and result in a sharp decline in democracy.
Which gets us to your fourth principle, shift the burden. And you contrast that with how Henry Ford, back about 100 years ago, doubled the minimum wage he paid his workers because he wanted them to have money to buy automobiles. And then you contrast it with what's going on now. So in the redesign of the economy, they basically shifted the burden so that even though people had trillions of dollars of mutual funds and pension savings, that they had no control over these huge monies. Those were controlled by the Wall Street banks and insurance companies, and that's what they speculated with. They speculated, as Brandeis once said, these banks speculate with other people's money. So talk about how they then shift the burden.
Well, the neoliberal programs do radically shift the burden. By now, especially since the Occupy movement put it on the public agenda, it's familiar, the 1%, the 99%. There's been a sharp increase in concentrated wealth for a very small part of the population, while the general population has either stagnated or, in fact, declined, as I mentioned. And that has an immediate effect on the political system through the mechanisms that I mentioned, including the huge increase in the role of the financial institutions. What Brandeis warned about was very small as compared with what's happening today. We see that in, well, just to mention some figures, there's substantial research in academic political science which compares people's attitudes with public policy. So it's fairly straightforward. Public policy, you see, there's extensive, pretty reliable polling information on people's attitudes, so you can compare them. And the results are quite stunning. Some of the best work was done by Martin Gillens, Larry Bartell, Benjamin Page, and others. What you find is that about maybe 70% of the population, of the lowest 70% on the wealth income scale, are essentially disenfranchised, meaning their own representatives pay no attention to their opinions. There's no correlation between what they want and what their own representatives act in their legislative function. Well, as you move up the income wealth scale, you get somewhat more influence. At the very top, policies are basically set. That's a very sharp decline in democracy, and it shows up in many ways. One of the respects in which it shows up is what today is called populism, strange use of the word, but what it means is tremendous anger, disillusionment, contempt for institutions, public attitudes towards Congress, the presidency, almost any institution you pick are very low. you see these centrist institutions that have been running the country in concert for a long time are collapsing. We just saw that in the last election here in the United States. In the November election, the two major forces, one was the Trump campaign, the other was the Sanders campaign. I mean, the Sanders campaign was in many ways much more remarkable. It broke with over 100 years of U.S. political history. Throughout this whole period, elections are pretty much bought. You can predict the outcome of an election pretty much by just taking a look at campaign spending, and that means predicting policy. Well, here came Bernie Sanders. No support from concentrated wealth, from the corporate sector, from the wealthy. The media either disregarded or ridiculed him, mostly unknown. He even used the scare word, socialism. He would have won the Democratic nomination if it hadn't been for the shenanigans of the Obama-Clinton party managers. On the other side, the Republicans, which was a pretty awful sight altogether, I should say, but someone came up who represented the popular base, and the Republican establishment couldn't stop him. The same thing's happening in other countries. The election in France just a couple days ago, the two major political groupings didn't even participate. They'd been wiped out. So you had two candidates who came from the outside, one with a neo-fascist background, the other an independent neoliberal who most of the public didn't like very much, but that was it. The same thing's happening in country after country. This anger and disillusionment, fear and scapegoating, hatred of others and so on, are reflecting the fact that there have been socioeconomic policies put in place which had the explicit objective of undermining democratic participation and were designed in ways that ensured huge growth of mostly predatory financial institutions and high concentration of wealth and stagnation or decline for the majority.
Which brings us to your fifth principle, attack solidarity. What do you mean by that?
Well, the way in which individuals without enormous wealth can defend themselves and protect their rights and advance justice and freedom is by acting together. If you have an atomized society with each person where the social unit is a person and his iPad or his television set or whatever it may be, and people are separated from one another, then they're easily controlled. The crucial part of this is labor unions. The labor unions, historically, way back to the 19th century, have been provided the means by which people can get together to learn, to exchange ideas, to produce programs, to act in concert, to carry forward progressive steps towards greater freedom, justice, and democracy. The labor unions have been in the forefront of these popular struggles for well over way back to the early Industrial Revolution. The New Deal was a striking example. The labor movement in the United States had pretty much been crushed in the 1920s, in part by Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare. But they reconstituted themselves in the 1930s, a CIO organizing militant labor actions, sit-down strikes, and so on. And they were the spearhead for the development of the New Deal policies, which, you know, didn't do everything, but they had a very beneficial effect, and it lasted. I mean, into the 1950s, for example, Dwight Eisenhower, representing what was then conservatism, not today, held that anyone who questions New Deal policies doesn't belong in the American political system. Anyone who made very powerful statements in support of labor rights and union organizing, again, he said, it was simply, you don't belong in the American political system unless you strongly support the right of workers to organize and associate them with one another. At that time, there already was of the beginnings of the post-war corporate attack on unions with some state participation.
Imagine that being said now by any Democrat, much less Republican. They hardly mention unions. And this gets us into Principle 6 in your book, Requiem for the American Dream. Run the regulators. You've already touched on that. But isn't it an amazing phenomena that they moved from weakening regulation to corporations over the years to deregulation, to taking law and order off the backs of these corporate predators, health, safety, economic regulations, banks and auto companies and mining companies. Now, under Trump, they have systematically appointed to head the EPA and the Food and Drug Administration and other departments people whose record and mission is to shut down the very agencies and departments that they take an oath of office to run under the law. I mean, this is clearly the most extreme. And that, of course, reflects your seventh principle, which is engineering elections. It's very important for these corporations in the plutocracy to control the main outlet of the democratic priorities of the people. Can you go into that a bit?
Well, that's, in fact, the Trump administration is a kind of a caricature of the policies that have been pursued throughout the whole neoliberal period. Deregulation was pursued extensively. It began in the late Carter years, took off under Reagan, and was even more extreme under Clinton, and then on. And it did have the natural effect of increasing corporate crime, increasing financial collapses, one after another. End of the Reagan administration, there was the savings and loan catastrophe. At the end of the Clinton administration, another collapse of the tech boom. Then, of course, the huge Great Recession of 2007-08. And it's worth remembering, as far as criminalization is concerned, that's been declining. So the savings and loan catastrophe, plenty of people were punished for their basically criminal activities. The much worse 2007-2008 crash, nobody was punished. There were fines, in fact, big fines, like the J.P. Morgan Chase, biggest bank, I think it had something like maybe a $13 billion fine. But when you take a look at it, first of all, it's tax deductible. Secondly, they have all kind of ways around it, and their profits are huge. And they ended up, the banks that were responsible for the crisis ended up richer than they were before.
Noam Chomsky in conversation with Ralph Nader. For the original recording, thanks to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. And thank you, dear listener, for listening to New World Notes. You'll find an archive of our shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, remember that you are not alone, and please don't forget that war is not healthy for children and other living things. Catch you later, I hope. Till then.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today includes an interview from Global Research TV from the website globalresearch.ca. It's an interview with James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com and Michelle Chesedovsky, one of the founders of globalresearch.ca, both really fantastic websites. The title of their interview is Global Warfare in the New World Order. And you'll hear about the many ways to wage war on all of us and who's doing it. As you listen to this, think about how 9/11 and other false flag events serve this global agenda. So here is the interview between Michelle Chesedovsky and James Corbett.
In all major regions of the world, in various forms, in some cases it's theater wars as in Yemen, in Syria and Iraq, it's a U.S.-sponsored insurgency, the so-called Islamic State. In Latin America, it's a process of destabilization of national economies, but also militarization, the sending in of Marines to Central America. In Southeast Asia and the Far East, it's the so-called pivot to Asia. It's a situation of provocation largely directed against China. In Ukraine, on Russia's border, it's acts of provocation directed against the Russian Federation and the conquest, essentially, of new frontiers for the global economy. In Africa, it's U.S.-sponsored insurgencies, the destabilization of national economies, the battle for oil. And largely, we're dealing with very powerful corporate actors, which control and overshadow the governments. If we wish to give it some kind of structure, we're talking about, of course, the oil companies, the big oil, the Anglo-American oil companies, Wall Street, of course, which is involved in financial destabilization, what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, which are the large defense contractors, the mercenary companies, the intelligence and security corporate apparatus linked, of course, to the U.S. Military and to NATO. And then, of course, you have the media conglomerates, which are there serving the process of war propaganda, upholding a corporate agenda. And then you also have, and that's very important, you have the biotech conglomerates, big pharma. One dimension of this global war is the destruction and demise of the agricultural cycle, the fact that when you introduce genetically modified seeds into a region such as sub-Saharan Africa, you not only destroy agriculture, but you destroy biodiversity and you undermine the livelihood of an entire region. And that's happening in countries like India. It's happening throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And it is part of that global agenda. The global warfare is not limited to military interventions. It uses covert operations. It also is geared towards destabilizing sovereign governments through so-called colored revolutions, you know, the installation of proxy regimes, which will obey orders, and so on and so forth. It's a very complex process, and we have to connect, in a sense, all the different dimensions of this devastating process, which is destroying countries, transforming sovereign nations into territories, open space for corporations, impoverishing the world population. And that impoverishment is not the consequence of a scarcity of resources. It is the result of manipulation and destruction of economic and social structures and institutions.
Well, you paint a very vivid and concise picture of the total carnage and warfare that is encircling the globe in a number of different aspects, and you, I think, rightly identify it as part of the corporate government collusion, the fascistic collusion, which is at the heart of this empire of chaos that is reigning around the globe. I guess the obvious question then is, what is the next stage of this global warfare? Does it develop into hot warfare in the traditional sense, or will it remain on an economic covert operations level?
Well, I think that, in a sense, the military planners have all options on the table, so to speak, to quote Hillary Clinton. They are involved in covert operations and regime change, the destabilization of national economies, economic sanctions, but they are also contemplating the use of high-tech weapon systems, of course, including nuclear war. And I say nuclear war is not only targeted towards, let's say, Russia and China using the arsenal of the Cold War era, in other words, the thermonuclear weapons, but it is also directed against non-nuclear states using the so-called tactical nuclear weapons. But then there are other systems, there are other areas of intervention. We know that the U.S. Air Force has command over environmental, what is called environmental modification techniques or weather warfare. It's a controversial subject, but it's fairly well documented that the U.S. military can modify the weather and trigger environmental catastrophes. And they even use the term, and I quote, owning the weather for military use. And then you have other areas of intervention. You have biological warfare, chemical warfare. You have, of course, there's the whole area of cyber warfare, the destabilization of countries' communication systems and so on. We're in the realm of high-tech communications. And another area, of course, of warfare is propaganda. It's turning realities upside down. It's presenting America as the protagonist of democracy and inciting people to endorse a so-called anti-terrorist agenda when it is known and documented that these terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda and more recently ISIS, the Islamic State, are creatures of U.S. intelligence. And so that we are now in a situation where we support a global war on terrorism, including sectors of the progressive left who say, well, we're against war, but we support the war on terrorism. It's a non sequitur. And within Western countries, there's also an internal war which is ongoing, which is the war of the governments and the corporations against their citizens, namely through the anti-terrorist legislation, where you can arrest people without any, just on suspicion because they're alleged terrorists and so on. And that trend now is evolving towards a situation of police state environment, which affects, of course, the fundamental rights of citizens. And that's happening in many countries in the West. And then with regard to the war within Western countries, you have the imposition of these deadly austerity measures. We see the situation in Greece, but it's not only in Greece. It's in countries like Spain, Italy, not to mention Iceland a few years back. And that, in a sense, is a form of internal warfare. It's based on debt conditionalities. It's the imposition of deadly macroeconomic reforms, something which has been applied in third world countries from the beginning of the 1980s, but which is now being applied in most Western countries, leading to the demise of social programs, the destruction of employment, the creation of mass unemployment, the removal of all social safety nets, and ultimately we're evolving, and I think both at the national and global level, we're evolving from a situation of poverty to despair. People, particularly if we take countries like India, where we see a whole range of suicides in the rural areas, which are largely attributable to the crisis of agriculture and the imposition of genetically modified seeds. Well, people commit suicide. In Africa, we see humanitarian disasters which are beyond, so to speak, they're beyond poverty. We're not dealing with global poverty, which was something which I researched in the 1990s. We're dealing with despair, with the destruction of livelihood, the destruction of family life, the deaths resulting from warfare, but also the deaths resulting from a process of engineered destruction of economic activity, where poor people are no longer the right to be poor. They're marginalized and excluded. And simultaneously, we see, we're looking at the realm of economics, we see the emergence of this upper-end luxury goods economy, which is geared towards a small segment of the population. So there's increased polarization, social polarization taking place everywhere. You won't see, if you're traveling in Southeast Asia, you won't see the poor people. You'll see avenues of hotels and condominiums and so on. So that, in a sense, what's happening is restructuring of the fabric of national societies, where the hope of actually acceding to the status of an employee or a worker within a factory may be a dream for many people who are simply marginalized. And that is a situation even happening in countries like Spain and Greece, where, you know, up to 40% of the labor force are unemployed.
Well, in fact, we see very much that war on the poorest of the poor, even in the heart of the empire itself, with many cities trying to even make feeding the homeless a crime of sorts in the United States. So we see this being waged, and more aggressively so. I guess then, can we see any countervailing tendencies towards this globalization of war?
Well, they are, of course, some very significant developments. If we look at the situation, let's say in Greece or in Spain, where seemingly progressive governments have emerged. But I should caution in that regard, because these seemingly progressive governments are often hijacked by corporate foundations which are funding them. It's the same thing with regard to NGOs, and they ultimately are caving in to the demands of the creditors and the large financial institutions. I think what has happened in the course of the last 20 or 30 years is that the whole fabric of particularly Western society, where you had trade unions, you had civil society organizations, which were, in fact, and you had governments, which were putting forth a progressive, a social democratic agenda. This scenario, this landscape has been totally modified. The resistance to this corporate agenda, and we're talking about global capitalism, is no longer there. It's no longer there. It's fragmented. It's co-opted. The trade union leaders go to Davos and mingle with the corporations, the corporate leaders, so that through the process of co-optation, we see a fragmentation of civil society into different areas, environmentalists on the one hand, anti-war on the other, women's rights. And ultimately, emerging from that is a mosaic of resistance rather than an organized structure which will challenge this project. And again, we're dealing with a military agenda. We're dealing with an economic agenda which is supported by the military agenda. We're dealing with a process of destabilization of livelihood, so to speak. It's the reproduction of real life which is at stake. And I think what is extremely dangerous in this situation is that those who decide, particularly with regard to the use of so-called, what we might describe as weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons, they believe their own propaganda. And there's a whole current within the U.S. military, we're talking about nuclear doctrine, to the fact that nuclear weapons are, quote, harmless to the surrounding civilian population. And that refers to the tactical nuclear weapons, the mini nukes. And there are other areas of where propaganda seems to take over the people who decide. And sometimes those people mean well. They think that by doing certain things, they're going to improve the livelihood of the world population. And so that when decision makers believe in the use of nuclear weapons as a means to bring peace to the world, we're in a very, very dangerous situation. And having consulted military documents, I can say that this is true, is that they say, well, we have to use war as a peacemaking undertaking, as a means to instill democracy. And they also say that nuclear weapons might be the avenue, okay, or certain type of nuclear weapons. And I should warn people, although this is a very complex subject, is that back in 2002, the U.S. Senate cleared the use of tactical nuclear weapons to be used in the conventional war theater, and that the whole notion that the commander-in-chief, namely the president of the United States, would actually give the green light, that has been scrapped. These tactical nuclear weapons are part of what they call the military toolbox. They can be used even by a three-star general in the region or in the war region, and they're part of the arsenal of conventional warfare. Now, all those things, all those dimensions, the economic, the social, the military dimensions, coalesce and are sustained by an extensive apparatus of media propaganda. I'm referring to the mainstream media, the corporate media, which sustains the lies and ultimately controls what people think. And this is not, this I would say, is an inquisitorial environment. It's much more devastating than the Spanish Inquisition. The Spanish Inquisition was also based on a big lie, and it lasted for 300 or 400 years. But we are dealing with a media apparatus which turns realities upside down, presents the Western quest and military adventure as a peacemaking undertaking, which lies with regard to the casualties of war, which presents the war criminals as protagonists of human rights, and so on and so forth. And that in itself is the pinnacle of this system. It really, without the mainstream media and war propaganda, this new world order agenda doesn't have a leg to stand on. And in other words, without these media lies, the military agenda, the economic agenda would collapse like a deck of cards. And that is why it is absolutely fundamental that within the realm of independent media and alternative media, we wage a war against the mainstream media. In other words, it's a war of ideas. It is an obligation on our part to support the truth and to use truth as a means, as a weapon, to undermine the legitimacy of this global economic and military agenda, which is destroying humanity. It is global war, it is total war, and it is destruction. And it has a logic, and it's part of global capitalism. But at this stage, it is not a struggle against socialism, but it is a struggle against national capitalism. In other words, it's the global capitalist elites, mainly Anglo-American, dominated by Wall Street and City of London, the large financial centers, against competing capitalist powers, which we might name them Russia, China. China's not a communist country. China's a capitalist country, in fact, a very advanced capitalist country, and so is Iran. And so that essentially what this war involves is world domination. It's the establishment of a global economic and political system whereby countries worldwide would be subordinated to these global corporations, where national sovereignty under national capitalism would be undermined. And the trade and investment agreements which are being negotiated behind closed doors are part of this agenda. They're part of this agenda, and in effect, they are the end game of this agenda, whereby global corporations undermine and destroy national and regional corporations, in other words, bankruptcy of the entire landscape, and impose a global economic agenda throughout the world.
And again, you've just been listening to an interview between James Corbett and Michelle Chusadovsky at Global Research TV. And again, James Corbett's website is CorbettReport.com, and Corbett is spelled CORBETT. And Michelle Chusadovsky's website is globalresearch.ca out of Canada. And Global Research was named as a fake news site. But if you've been paying attention, you know that the real fake news is the corporately controlled so-called mainstream media. Without the corporate media and some co-opted so-called alternative media supporting this global agenda, the globalists would fail. It's the truly independent media that allows us to have some inkling of what's really going on. And that's why the globalists have really begun to crack down on and attack the independent media by labeling many of them as, quote, fake news, and by limiting their internet access. Congress, which dangles on the puppet strings of the globalists, has even recently encouraged Facebook and Google and others to censor many good websites. And Facebook and Google and the others are changing their algorithms so that when you do a search for a topic, the sites like Global Research won't come up and won't be one of your choices. And Global Research and others have reported that the hits to their sites have gone way, way down because of this. I don't know about you, but when the powers that be are trying to keep me from these independent news sources, I want to connect with them all the more. So in addition to globalresearch.ca and thecorbettreport.com, here are some other sites that I would recommend if you want to learn about what's really going on. One is newsbud.org, started by Sibel Edmonds and other great independent journalists. Sibel has been labeled the most gagged woman in history for when she worked at the FBI after 9/11 and what she discovered there. Anyway, the site newsbud.org is a subscription site, so you need to subscribe, but you can also find some of the less current videos on YouTube. So if you go to YouTube and look for NewsBud, there's some there. And they do a great job at NewsBud of really digging into the deep state. And I just saw today that they posted a new video on the murder of John Lennon. And so again, that's newsbud.org. Another site I would recommend is WayneMadsonReport.com. Again, WayneMadsonReport.com. And as a former employee of the NSA, he has connections to the intelligence community. So his site is really worth checking out. Lots of great information there. And another good site is 21stCenturyWire.org. They do a great job covering the Middle East and Syria. And then another site is InternationalClearinghouse.com. And for 9/11, the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth site has all the scientific evidence needed to prove that the official account of how the towers came down to be totally fraudulent. And again, their website is ae911truth.org. So ae911truth.org. And it's important to understand that we've been lied to about 9/11 and that it couldn't have been pulled off by the 19 alleged Muslim hijackers, because the globalists, just mentioned by Michelle Chusadovsky, who are waging war on all of us, used 9/11 to further their global takeover agenda, blaming it on Al-Qaeda, who they actually created, armed, and funded with the help of certain allies. They also did the same with ISIS, as you heard Michelle Chusadovsky mention. Another weapon used by the globalists against us is to control the weather. Even Michio Kaku came out recently and said on CBS that the government can modify the weather and can create hurricanes, etc. Chemtrails are connected to the weather modification program, and a good website to learn more about all of this is
Geoengineering Watch. I think it's .org. So geoengineeringwatch.org. So there are some things that each of us can do to thwart the globalist corporatist takeover in our own small way. So let's start with the oil companies. We could look into getting solar panels and join organizations like PACE right here in Connecticut to learn more about sustainable energy. And when it comes to Wall Street, we could tell everyone that we know that the Federal Reserve Bank is not federal and that there's very little reserve in the bank. They're a private bank charging interest to our government for borrowed money. And we could keep our money in smaller local banks and credit unions rather than using the big corporate banks. And we could work to get a public bank here in Connecticut. And there are already people working on this. And in terms of the corporate media, you know, we can all just turn them off and watch or read them only for monitoring purposes. And you can support independent media outlets, as many of you did recently during our fund drive here at WWUH. And I want to thank all who donated. It really is greatly appreciated. And when it comes to genetically modified foods, we could just not eat the poison and buy organic foods or foods with the non-GMO label on them and then work to get them banned like they are in many other countries. And we could also pressure our local farmers not to use genetically modified seeds. And when it comes to big pharma, you really need to learn all you can about vaccines. Two movies that cover this well are Vaxxed, V-A-X-X-E-D, and Bought, B-O-U-G-H-T, Bought. And I believe they're both on YouTube right now. So Vaxxed and Bought. And then we all need to learn more about the corporate organization called ALEC, A-L-E-C, which is designed to get corporately friendly laws passed in each state legislature. And they've been very successful so far. And again, that's ALEC, A-L-E-C. So as I see it, the only thing that's going to stop the globalist takeover of the world, the New World Order, as they say, is collective people power. So if not you and me, then who? And if you would like to comment on the show or add your own suggestions for what we can do, I've created a new email address, which is wwuhcheryl@aol.com. And again, that's wwuhcheryl@aol.com. And that's Cheryl, C-H-E-R-Y-L. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up.
Next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Mack. Too often, low-wage women workers have been subjected to sexual violence in their workplace, but their voices have oftentimes been silenced or eclipsed. We're off to join the formidable farm worker women leaders of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers for a major Harvest Without Violence March. The CIW women traveled to the Big Apple to demand a meeting with Wendy's board chairman and major shareholder, Nelson Peltz, in order to share their powerful stories and demand Wendy's do its part to end sexual violence in the fields. We joined farm workers for a massive boycott Wendy's march through Midtown to the Park Avenue offices. We'll declare that farm worker women should not have to surrender their dignity for the right to put food on their family's table.
Forget Wendy's! Move Wendy's! Get out the way! Get out the way! And come in here, then! Move on!
What an honor it is to have the Coalition of Immokalee Workers here! 25 to 30 CIW members drove 28 hours to be here for this action. Wendy's, we say, you have no idea who you're messing with. Yeah. And with that, we want to introduce the amazing Nelly Rodriguez and Sylvia of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
Yo soy Silvia y yo soy miembro de la Coalición de Trabajadores.
My name is Silvia and I'm a member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
Al no unirse al programa, ellos están apoyando los problemas que existen en México. Ellos están bien felices comprando sus vegetales, sus verduras en México, donde existen explotaciones con los trabajadores o niños trabajando en los campos. Eso no queremos. Queremos que Wendy's regrese de México a comprar su producto en Florida, donde hay trabajadores que ya están teniendo sus derechos de reportar los problemas que no existen en México, donde ellos están haciendo sus compras.
And we don't know what's wrong with Wendy's, why they're taking so long to think about this decision. Instead of joining the Fair Food Program, they have just shifted their purchases to Mexico, where there is sexual violence, where there is child labor, where workers continue to experience abuse, instead of joining a proven solution here with the Fair Food Program, where workers are having their rights respected, they can report abuses, and there are human rights in the fields for the first time.
Ellos tienen un código de conducta que está funcionando. Eso está funcionando en la memoria de ellos, pero no está funcionando con los trabajadores. Eso no es justo lo que están haciendo. Vamos a seguir luchando y gracias a ustedes que están aquí a la pie de lucha con los trabajadores. Las 14 corporaciones que ya están trabajando se ganaron también con el apoyo de ustedes.
We don't know what they're thinking. They have a code of conduct that they say is working, but we know that that's only working in their heads. Yeah. It's not actually protecting the human rights of farm workers. So we thank all of you as consumers for being out here, because the 14 corporations who are participating in the Fair Food Program have only come because of actions with you, and that is how we're going to bring Wendy's into the Fair Food Program.
Yeah. Wendy's, escucha, estamos en la lucha.
The amazing Reverend Michael Livingston of Riverside Church, who has stood with the CIW for so many years, to tell us about this delegation that just tried to go inside to Nelson Peltz's office.
Listen, we've been thrown out of better places than this. They're afraid to talk to us. They're afraid of farm worker women and their children.
We cannot eat food from a place that does not respect women,
where women are not safe in the fields from abuse. The United Presbyterian Church, the Presbyterian Church in the USA, and the United Church of Christ have already voted to endorse this boycott. New York City Presbyterians have voted to join this boycott. And just about a week ago, the Episcopal Diocese of New York voted to join. So we are proud and honored to host the farm worker women and their families at the Riverside Church while they're here. People of faith are going to stand with farm workers from Immokalee until Wendy's comes to its senses. Boycott
Wendy's! Your burgers may be fair, but your food ain't fair!
Let's hear it for Kanisha and Victoria from SFA!
My name is Kunisha. I'm currently have the great opportunity to not only be interning, but living in Immokalee. And on behalf of the students nationally, we're not only boycotting Wendy's, but we are demanding that Nelson Peltz use his power in the supply chain to end the abuses that are happening. The students will continue to demand and boycott Wendy's until Nelson Peltz get onto the table and understand the power that he has to change how the women are living and working in the fields. And to the coalition, and to the farm worker women, we as students will continue to amplify your message and to educate thousands around the nation that they should be standing up for your rights.
As students, we face sexual violence in our campuses. 65% of women in college campuses are victims of sexual assault and harassment. But in the field, this number is 80%. Even though sexual violence and assaults and harassments are systemic issues, the coalition has found a way to end this in the fields by signing on to the Fair Food Program and being able to almost eliminate sexual violence. But Wendy's has said no to this. They have said no to signing on and to protecting farmworker women. But as students, we have a power, not only as consumers, but as people who are also in this fight, to say no and to boot Wendy's off of our campuses and to boot the Braves until Nelson Peltz signs on to the Fair Food Program.
Ain't no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop. Say what?
Ain't no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop. Say what? Ain't no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop. Say what?
We are thrilled to have with us Rabbi Rachel Khan Traster of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. It has been TRUA's pleasure to be one of the major Jewish allies of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. This past May at the Wendy's shareholder meeting, when a rabbi from TRUA asked Nelson Peltz when he would meet with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and TRUA, he said that he didn't need to meet with us because he had enough rabbis in his life. What he doesn't understand is that until Wendy's signs the Fair Food Program, he'll have not just plenty of rabbis in his life, but plenty of all of us. Consumers, students, farm workers, people of faith, bringing the message of fair food to his doorstep until he does the right thing. A delegation of women rabbis and women farm workers came to this very spot to try and get Nelson Peltz to meet with us. Because we, as rabbis, as women, want to stand together with the farmworker women who have said, we are making changes in our own industry and you need to listen to us. But would he let us in? No. That's why we're all here together, to be united, to stand up for justice and tell Wendy's that until they come to the table with the coalition and join the Fair Food Program, we will be saying, boycott!
Wendy's!
Boycott!
Wendy's!
to hear from some very special CIW members. The CIW Youth!
Hola, mi nombre es Jorge y vengo a Nueva York representando a los niños de Immokalee.
Hi everyone, my name is Jorge and I am here representing the kids of Immokalee.
Estamos aquí porque estamos lado a lado con nuestras madres que también están luchando con nosotros.
We are shoulder to shoulder with our mothers who are fighting for justice.
Sabemos que nuestras madres o otras señoras que trabajan en los campos enfrentan acoso sexual y muchas otras cosas que no nos gustan.
We know that our mothers and other women in Immokalee face sexual violence and other things that we don't like.
Entonces, vamos a seguir luchando con nuestras madres hasta que ellos firmen el acuerdo.
So we're going to keep on in the struggle with our mothers until Wendy signs the Fair Food Program.
My name is Irvin Rodriguez. I am the son of Nelly Rodriguez, and I represent the kids of Immokalee, and we are fighting so Wendy's can join the Fair Food Program. We're out here because Wendy's and Nelson Peltz are always going to Mexico and other countries to get the tomatoes. And in Mexico, some farm workers face sexual harassment, and we don't like that.
Let's hear it for the kids who came all the way from Immokalee and teenagers! Next up, we have the great honor of having peace poets in the house.
When I say people, y'all say power, people, people. And when I say estamos, you say juntos, estamos, estamos. It's so good to be with you. We are two out of the five peace poets. It's an honor to be able to be here with the workers and their families. We want to sing together. Are y'all down to sing with us? We have an important message that's very simple. Let me hear you say, you are not alone.
You are not alone.
We are in the struggle with the workers.
We are in the struggle with the workers.
No están solas.
No están solas.
Estamos en la lucha con las trabajadoras.
Estamos en la lucha con las trabajadoras.
Sing so they can hear you upstairs. Sing so they can hear you in these cars. Sing it so they hear you across the country. No están solas. No están solas. Estamos en la lucha con las trabajadoras. No están solas. No están solas. Estamos en la lucha con las
Tonight I just got here from work, and I work with young people, teenagers in the Bronx. And the way that we closed our session was by saying what they wanted the workers to know. If you believe that these trabajadoras are our leaders, I need you to say, she is my leader.
She is my leader.
I fight for her.
I fight for her.
There we go. And the other part is in Spanish, and it just says, queremos libertad por cada trabajadora.
Queremos libertad por cada trabajadora.
Let's go. She is our leader and we are fighting for her. Queremos libertad por cada trabajadora.
Más fuerte.
She is our leader and we are fighting for her. Queremos libertad por cada trabajadora.
Dos veces más.
She is our leader, and we are fighting for her.
Queremos libertad por cada trabajador.
Gracias, les queremos.
Give it up for Peace
Poets! Thank you to everyone, and we hope that you will take this message of hope for justice to your communities, to your campuses, to your families, everywhere, because we are hopeful. We continue to take this message of hope everywhere.
we're in a very elite spot in New York. There's a lot of signs here complaining about Wendy's, but why don't you tell us what brings you to 49th Street and Park Avenue to talk about your story?
Yo soy Nelly Rodriguez y soy parte de la coalición de trabajadores de Immokalee. Estamos aquí porque tenemos un poder bien fuerte. Aquí está este señor, Nelson Peltz, presidente de la mesa directiva de Wendy's, y hasta la fecha de hoy, rehusado a tener una entrevista con nosotros, una junta.
My name is Nelly Rodriguez. I'm a farm worker and a member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. We're here gathered as farm workers and allies of farm workers in front of the headquarters of Trion Partners, a company run by Nelson Peltz, who is also the chair of the board of Wendy's, the largest actual shareholder in Wendy's as well. We've been trying to speak to him about the Fair Food Program, and so far, unfortunately, he's refused to even meet with us. But we know that he is in a position where he is able to help us create the change that we're seeking.
Talk to us about the Fair Food Program. Why is it needed? What is it?
El programa por comida justa es un programa que hemos desarrollado los trabajadores del campo, que funciona con la participación de corporaciones, los rancheros y nosotros como trabajadores del campo. Hemos diseñado demandas para mejorar las condiciones, mejorar los sueldos, acabar con los abusos, el acoso sexual y la violencia en el campo. Entonces las corporaciones no pueden comprar tomate de los ranchos si no están respetando estas tres demandas hacia los trabajadores.
So the Fair Food Program is a worker design program collaboration between participating buyers, participating growers, and of course, very importantly, farm workers themselves. The Fair Food Program is based on three demands that we've made of participating buyers. These three demands are things that the current participating buyers have agreed to. The first is that they pay just a penny more for every pound of tomatoes that they buy, which helps ensure that farm workers picking those tomatoes make a living wage. The second, they agree to buy from participating growers who are upholding a worker-designed code of conduct. The third is that a very important piece of that code of conduct is a zero-tolerance policy for sexual harassment and violence. With these pieces, these participating buyers, growers, and of course farm workers themselves are putting an end to human rights abuses in the fields, including sexual harassment and violence.
Why don't you tell our listeners about your personal experience as a woman farm worker and now as an activist.
Todos los que somos parte de la industria agrícola en la costa este de la Florida, cuando estamos en el trabajo, hemos experimentado mucho lo que es el acoso sexual, violencia, y te estoy hablando de patrones que anteriormente usaban ese poder para humillar, acosar sexualmente a trabajadoras, prometiéndoles o amenazándoles cosas para de ese modo ellos lograr su propósito. Por muchos años las trabajadoras hemos tenido que soportar estas humillaciones y no queremos que siga pasando esto. Queremos seguir luchando para que se nos respete nuestra dignidad, y la solución es que las corporaciones tomen esa responsabilidad y se comprometan a participar, corporaciones como Wendy's.
Our story is really a community story, and as farm worker women, we're here today talking specifically about a history of sexual abuse and violence that's happened in the fields. For so many years, crew leaders and bosses working in the fields were able to commit these things totally unchecked, with impunity. They would threaten women in the fields, they would sexually harass and were sexually violent toward women without any sort of accountability. And we're here as women farm workers saying it's time to put an end to that. Actually, there is a verifiable way that we have to put an end to that. And so now we're inviting Wendy's to be a part of that program, the Fair Food Program, to say, this can happen no more, and we're going to do our part as a company to ensure that these things no longer happen in our supply chain. And so that's really why we're here today.
Y bueno, Nelson Peltz es el presidente de la mesa directiva de Wendy's, y él tiene el poder de traer a Wendy's a comprometerse a acabar con el acoso sexual, y puede hacer que haya más respeto en las cadenas de surtidores de Wendy's. Nelson Peltz no ha hecho eso. Ya hemos hecho llamado por 4 años de estar llamando a que sea parte del programa y se ha negado. Están ahora comprando tomates de México, de los ranchos, donde sabemos que existe lo que es acoso sexual, Ese rancho ha recibido demandas por no pagar a 400 trabajadores y también por tener a niños trabajando ahí.
We're here specifically today also to make that demand of Nelson Peltz, that he do his part in the powerful position that he occupies to bring Wendy's to the table with us as farm workers. He is the chair of the board of Wendy's, he's the largest shareholder of Wendy's, the chairman of the corporate social responsibility committee of the board of Wendy's, and so he really has a powerful role to play in bringing Wendy's to do the right thing. But unfortunately right now Wendy's is instead choosing to stand on the side of violence and impunity and continues to buy from Mexican growers where there is an endemic situation of violence and sexual violence towards women working there. We've also seen situations where hundreds of workers have gone unpaid on those Mexican farms, as well as child labor. And so there's really a decision that Wendy's is consciously making here, and we know that there is an alternative, and that's really what we're inviting them to do today, is to choose that alternative and stand with us as farm workers and join the Fair Food Program.
We are hearing story after story in the United States about the sexual harassment of women. They are victimized and have no recourse. I'm wondering what you have to say about women who have been at the mercy of patrones, of bosses, of jefes, who have been really aggressive, sexually harassed, I dare say raped and abused women who have been subjected to sexual harassment, sexual violence and abuse.
Esto es algo que es un tema que ahorita está como levantando muchos comentarios y mucha atención hacia el acoso sexual que enfrentan, por ejemplo, las artistas de Hollywood, que enfrentan las personas que trabajan en otras industrias y en otros trabajos. Y sí es feo para cualquier mujer estar pasando por un acoso sexual por el simple hecho de sacar adelante a tu familia. Es algo que no se debe de permitir y estamos en contra también nosotras de eso. Pero se habla de un porcentaje muy alto, el 80% de mujeres que sufren acoso sexual sin otra opción, sin derechos, ni ayuda de ningún tipo, son las mujeres agrícolas. Y no se escucha esto, siendo que las mujeres agrícolas son las que cosechan las frutas y vegetales que alimentan a todo este país.
Yeah, and so this is a topic, sexual harassment and sexual violence towards women, that's gaining a lot of attention right now. And we see that many women in Hollywood, for example, are speaking out. Many women in powerful white-collar industries are being heard, and that is very important. Obviously, we stand with those women, and we think that it's very important that they are able to take action and have some recourse. But we're also here shining a light on the fact that farm worker women and women in other industries as well are facing these same sorts of things. And in fact, in the agriculture industry, for example, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, about 80% of women have faced some sort of sexual harassment or abuse on the job. And that's an extremely high percentage. And so what we're saying here today is that this also needs to be recognized, and we also need to do something to put an end to that. And that, again, is why we're here today, because we have a solution to put an end to that, that we're asking Wendy's to be a part of.
So how does this fair trade demand that you are putting towards Wendy begin to deal with the kind of misery that women have faced from the growers?
Esto es algo que no lo decimos nosotros, que la solución para acabar con el acoso sexual y la esclavitud y la violencia en la industria agrícola en la Florida es el programa Por Comida Justa, porque hay una consecuencia para los abusadores que están haciendo este tipo de acoso o de violencia en los campos y que no respetan este código de conducta, estos nuevos derechos que hay para los trabajadores. Las corporaciones, que ya tenemos 14 que también están apoyando para que haga estos derechos y protección para las mujeres, no pueden comprar tu tomate de los ranchos cuando sucede un caso de acoso sexual.
there are a couple of really important components to the Fair Food Program that help put an end to sexual violence and abuse in the fields. The first is that worker voices are at the center of this, that they themselves are frontline advocates for their own human rights. And the second is that there are very real market consequences. Participating buyers who are part of the Fair Food Program are saying, we are not going to buy from growers who continue to let these abuses to happen. There's a zero tolerance policy, and they've agreed to actually cut their purchases from those growers if these things are found to be happening. So it's a real incentive for these growers to proactively ensure that sexual violence and harassment are not happening in their fields. And currently there are 14 corporate buyers who have joined this program and are a part of creating that change.
And indeed, it's time for Wendy's. It's overtime, and you certainly won the hearts and the minds of the people here. You're absolutely splendid, and we will be there to support our sisters, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. We've been speaking with, who is my firebrand, who is my wonderful sister here?
Nelly Rodriguez.
And who is our spectacular translator?
My name is Joe Parker. I'm an ally.
Thank you both so much.
Gracias.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. And I've got one more. Tell us the importance of being here.
I am thrilled that over 200 people came to this protest. Everyone from different universities, from high schools in the area as well. Such a diversity of people here in solidarity with farmworker women. 33 people from Immokalee traveling over 28 hours to be here in New York City just to ask for a meeting with Nelson Peltz. And to not even have a meeting with them is shameful. And that's the reason that everybody came out here in support. And we've only seen the support and these protests growing. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is going to be here until they sign.
Who are you?
My name is Patricia, and I'm a representative with the Alliance for Fair Food, which is the national network of consumers across the country that supports the Campaign for Fair Food and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in their struggle for dignity and human rights in the fields. The CAW is doing an incredible job of uncovering abuses and so strategically understanding where the power lies in the industry and how to turn it on its head so that it benefits the most vulnerable among us, led by the most vulnerable themselves.
What do we do to make sure that happens?
Excellent question, and you're asking the right person.
Aha!
What you need to do is to visit the boycott-wendys.org website and join the boycott. That means signing up to our email list and receiving calls to action that come out periodically. So the call to action for people in New York City was to come out to this protest. Hundreds joined in. It was amazing. The call to action for everyone else across the country was to pick up the phone and call Nelson Peltz's offices. And that, like that, there are mobilizations that happen at Wendy's headquarters across the country. There are moments in which we call on all consumers to organize a Wendy's manager letter delivery or to organize a protest. The next one coming up is January 18th, when we're calling on clergy to organize a witness outside of a Wendy's restaurant in commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the 30-day hunger strike that six workers led down in Immokalee back when they were still challenging the growers before they realized that the power in the industry lie in the corporations. In commemoration of this nearly 30-year struggle, and in understanding that we have to continue the struggle to make sure that these human rights reach all workers. So that's January 18th. And again, the website is boycott-wendys.org.
We're going to see you in indescribable multiples on January 18th. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
I'm here at the Supreme Court today because I respectfully declined to create a custom cake that would celebrate a view of marriage in direct conflict with my faith's core teachings.
When I hire a baker, I'm not hiring them to give their speech. I'm hiring them so that my speech can be expressed.
This has never been about a cake. This is about freedom for LGBT people to live full lives in public and not in constant fear that they will be denied basic service just for who they are.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Austria's top court declares civil marriage equality. A Tanzanian lesbian is arrested after her videoed romance goes viral. And the U.S. Supreme Court considers free speech, creativity, and anti-queer bias. Those stories and more this week now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending December 9th, 2017. Austria's constitutional court has opened civil marriage to same-gender couples and opened civil partnerships to heterosexual couples who prefer that status to marriage. The nation's highest court removed the heterosexuals-only language of marriage laws in its December 4th decision, ruling that restricting same-gender couples to less-than-equal civil partnerships, which had been available to them since 2010, was discriminatory. However, the court said its ruling would not come into effect until January 1, 2019, unless the country's incoming new administration decides to open marriage to lesbian and gay couples sooner than that. According to Pink News, since it will likely be a coalition government of the right-wing Austrian People's Party and the hard-right Freedom Party, that's not likely to happen. The justices did specify that the plaintiff couples directly involved in the constitutional court case could marry sooner than January 2019, unless other obstacles speak against it. Austria joins recent European marriage equality converts Finland, Malta, and Germany. Weddings began in those three countries this year.
The head of Cambodia's Human Rights Committee was one of the prominent speakers at the 7th International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association Asia Conference, held December 4th through 8th in Phnom Penh. Kiu Remne encouraged attendees to continue pressuring the Cambodian government to end discrimination and extend legal recognition, but in a slow and respectful way. Even though there are no laws against private consensual adult same-gender sex in Cambodia, social stigma is still widespread. We may take some time to educate the people in the community, he said. More than 300 people took part in the conference under the theme United for Love, including activists from some 30 countries, development partners, organizations, diplomatic representatives, and local officials. A movement for marriage equality in the Southeast Asian country has been growing. But there's been pushback by Prime Minister Hun Sen, who started to crack down on political opposition, independent media, and human rights groups, including the NGO Cambodian Center for Human Rights, which has expressed strong support for LGBT equality in recent years. Sen claims that it's a discredited organization that was created by foreigners.
The marriage equality movement is also growing in Japan. As the Kyoto News Service noted, six local governments recognize same-gender couples and treat them the same as married heterosexuals, although their unions are not legally recognized for purposes of public housing, visiting a partner in the hospital, or inheriting property, because a same-gender partner is not considered to be a family member under federal law. The national government continues to resist moves to change the marriage statutes, while several cell phone operators, life insurers, and hospitals have started to recognize same-gender couples as families. The city of Osaka also officially recognized two men as foster parents earlier this year. Recent remarks by senior lawmaker Wataru Takeshita of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party that same-gender partners of state guests should not be invited to banquets hosted by Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko because it doesn't fit with Japan's tradition, drew strong criticism from many quarters. Mr. Takeshita may not be able to assume that there are LGBTs in Japan, said openly gay law professor and activist Ken Suzuki. He may not be able to assume it is possible that a Japanese prime minister may bring a same-sex partner to a banquet someday. Takeshita later apologized.
A woman in Tanzania has learned the hard way that being video recorded on a friend's cell phone is not always a good idea. The unnamed woman, said to be a worker at the local gold mine and between 30 and 40 years of age, was arrested in the northwestern town of Giata after a video of her allegedly hugging, kissing, and presenting another woman with a ring went viral. Regional Commissioner Robert Gabriel told reporters that the country's laws are clear as homosexuality is not allowed, and we will ensure that the law takes its course. It's believed that police are still searching for the woman who appeared in the video accepting the ring. Carnal knowledge of any person against the order of nature is illegal in the East African country, and convictions carry a sentence of up to life in prison. Since he took power in 2015, President John Magufuli has started to rival the leaders of neighboring Uganda and Kenya with escalating crackdowns on sexual minorities. 13 people were arrested in October at a hotel HIV/AIDS prevention workshop, and Tanzania's health minister banned the sale of lube in 2016 to supposedly discourage men from having sex with men. This week's arrest of the videotaped woman is thought to be the first in the country for alleged lesbian activity.
The Trump administration is being dragged, kicking and screaming, to court-ordered acceptance of qualified transgender military service members on January 1st. U.S. District Judge Colleen Collar Cotelli demanded last week that the Pentagon begin accepting transgender recruits on that date, rather than waiting until March for the results of yet another study of the impact of trans troops on enlistees ordered earlier this year by Defense Secretary James Mattis. The Justice Department filed a motion for an emergency stay of that order late this week and asked for an immediate ruling. The Trump administration is trying to reverse yet another progressive policy of the Obama administration, which had approved opening military service to qualified transgender troops in July of this year before that was scuttled by Trump's infamous tweets. At least four federal lawsuits challenging Trump's proposed trans ban have been filed. A second district court last week echoed Collar Cotelli's original October decision that the transgender plaintiffs are likely to win on constitutional grounds. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has confirmed that it is now taking steps to prepare for the court-ordered January 1st deadline. It's unclear how many trans people will actually sign up, however, considering the still unresolved legal issues that cloud their possible military careers.
In other news, one half of one of the gay couples who were infamously denied marriage licenses by Kentucky clerk Kim Davis returned to the Rowan County Courthouse this week. But this time, David Ermold was there to file papers to run against Davis. She announced her re-election campaign last week. It will be the first time she'll face the voters since refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples 2 years ago, for which she spent a few days in jail for contempt of court, only to emerge as a martyred darling of the religious right. Changes in state law eventually allowed her to keep her job and not have to personally sign the marriage licenses of same-gender couples. The 43-year-old Ermold is an English professor at the University of Pikeville and director of Moorhead Pride. He won't be the only challenger to Kim Davis, but he'll probably be the only one raising the incumbent's homophobia. But he rejected what he called the divide-and-conquer style of politicking. "This campaign we are putting together," he said, "is about unity and bringing people together and restoring fairness." The Associated Press reported that Ermold's candidacy has already attracted some national attention. Comedian and actor Patton Oswalt sent Ermold a tweet asking, "Anything I can do to help?"
And finally, a lopsided majority in Australia's House, as expected, passed legislation to open civil marriage to same-gender couples on December 7th, without any crippling amendments. Four MPs went on record as opposed, while 10 MPs stayed out of the chamber and abstained from voting altogether, including former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who ignored his constituents' nearly 4-1 vote for marriage equality in the national postal plebiscite that concluded in mid-November. The House action came on the heels of overwhelming passage of a companion bill in the Senate on November 29th. The measure was officially signed into law on December 8th by Governor General Peter Cosgrove on behalf of Queen Elizabeth II, Australia's constitutional head of state. Because the country's marriage laws require a 30-day waiting period after any couple declares its intention to wed, lesbian and gay couples will have to wait until January 9th to start walking down the aisle. However, the new law immediately recognizes the marriages of Australian same-gender couples who've legally wed in other countries. Here's what one of Australia's proudest moments sounded like.
As there are fewer than five members on the side for the noes in this division, I declare the question resolved in the affirmative in accordance with Standing Order 127. The names of those members who are in the minority will be recorded in the votes and proceedings. The clerk.
Third reading, a bill for an act to amend the law relating to the definition of marriage and protect religious freedoms and for related purposes.
That's it.
People in the House gallery spontaneously celebrated in song with what some Aussies would prefer to be their national anthem.
NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending December 9th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
The U.S. Supreme Court on December 11th refused to hear a Georgia lesbian's job discrimination case to determine whether or not LGBT people are covered under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which bans bias based on sex. Several other Title VII cases are being considered by federal courts across the country.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Clinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
I'm Stephen Fry.
I'm Harvey Milk.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm Tab Hunter.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
I'm Robbie Kaplan.
I'm Barney Frank.
I'm Cleve Jones.
My name is Kate Kendall.
I'm Dan Savage.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, and you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
And those who love them.
There's been a lot of noise in the air this year. You might even call it sound and fury. You can help defeat the noise by joining This Way Out's year-end campaign at thiswayout.org.
If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. Hachi-do, hachi-do, hachi-do.
The questions were whose free speech and discrimination against whom when a politically divided U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on December 5th in a case about much more than just cake. If American fiction were the point, the case of the Colorado baker and the gay couple looking for a wedding cake would not have such enormous implications for LGBT civil rights. Is it about art? Swing vote Justice Anthony Kennedy was skeptical when it came to the argument that the baker, who considers himself to be an artist, could not be forced to create messages with which that artist disagrees. On the other hand, Justice Kennedy also did not seem to believe that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission displayed tolerance or respect for the baker's religious beliefs when it found that his refusal to make the couple's cake violated the state's non-discrimination law. On the steps of the Supreme Court, Baker Jack Phillips was emotional about what he called the favorite part of his job.
Designing a custom cake and creating them allow me to use my artistic vision to create works of art that are beautiful and distinctive and that mark the beginning of something sacred. I'm here at the Supreme Court today because I respectfully declined to create a custom cake that would celebrate a view of marriage in direct conflict with my faith's core teachings on marriage.
Customer David Mullins and his husband Charlie Craig were just as emotional about the mortification and humiliation the incident caused them. Mullins said it's not about cake to them.
This has never been about a cake. And this isn't about weddings. It has never been about weddings. No, this is about freedom. Freedom for LGBT people to live full lives in public and not in constant fear that they will be denied basic service in businesses, fired from their jobs, or lose their homes just for who they are. When people live in a world where they can legally be turned away, they feel rejected. They feel unsafe.
Public News Service reporter Eric Galatas has more from Denver.
Colorado law prohibits businesses like Masterpiece from discriminating based on a range of characteristics, including race, sex, nationality, religion, and sexual orientation. Craig Conniff, an associate professor at the University of Colorado Law School, says the court's decision could have broad implications for anti-discrimination laws in Colorado and across the nation.
What this law and laws like it do, they're basically trying to address that history of discrimination and protect LGBT individuals in a range of areas. So if they want to go to the doctor, a grocery store, or a restaurant, this law prevents them from being kicked out.
Phillips' lawyer claims that Baker is an artist and should not be forced to express what the government dictates. An amicus brief filed on behalf of 20 states and a brief from the U.S. Justice Department makes similar arguments. Conniff disagrees and says a cake ordered at a bakery serving the general public does not represent the expression of the shop owner.
When I hire a baker, when I hire someone to make a billboard, I'm not hiring them to give their speech. I'm hiring them so that my speech can be expressed. So I think that they're wrong in saying that this is the baker's speech as opposed to this being a couple's speech.
In the Colorado Court of Appeals 2015 ruling, justices cited a 1964 challenge to the Civil Rights Act where a court ruled that a business owner could not refuse to serve black people based on religious beliefs. Justices said Phillips could voice his opposition to gay marriage on a sign or on the store's website, but picking and choosing customers based on their sexual orientation was against Colorado law. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatas.
Andy Hum and Ann Northrup of Gay USA TV took apart the proceedings and the players.
Four of the justices, Alito, Thomas, Roberts, and Gorsuch, were appallingly, you know, with the baker on this. I mean, Alito was saying, you being forced to write something. No, he's not being forced to write something. It's how he, you know, he's making roses on a cake, okay? That's what he does for everybody.
And the four liberal justices, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Breyer, were clearly on the side of the same-sex couple and their right not to be discriminated against and to be treated equally with everyone else in the public realm.
So we might as well have just made it a colloquy and had the case heard by Anthony Kennedy.
He is the linchpin at the moment. You can predict any kind of outcome based on what Anthony Kennedy said.
He seemed to have a couple of deep concerns, one of which was the what he felt was anti-religious animus, hostility of one of the commissioners on the Civil Rights Commission.
In considering this case, she said she was tired of religion being used to excuse discrimination and ill treatment of stigmatized people, and that she found this despicable.
She said, look, the Holocaust, slavery, were done in the name of religion. And she said, that's despicable.
So Anthony Kennedy turns this around to claim that she is calling religion despicable. And really what she's saying is that religion is being misused
right.
in horrible ways by people who are manipulating these situations and inappropriately claiming a religious view to promote things like the Holocaust or slavery.
He's torn. He is a very conservative justice who has written all four major gay rights decisions in our favor, okay? But he has also signed on to the Hobby Lobby decision, which...
I think is crucial in this case.
Right, which absolutely allowed a private business to invoke its religion and not give coverage for contraception. Kennedy asked the Solicitor General of the United States, representing our government now under the Trump administration,
which has switched sides in this case,
can the bakery put up a sign that says, no wedding cakes for gay couples? And he said it could say yes, And it, as long as it said no custom cakes.
And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked at the White House press briefing shortly after these arguments, does the president agree, since his solicitor general said this, that businesses should be allowed to post signs saying no custom wedding cakes for gay people?
The lawyer from the Solicitor General's office for the administration said today in court, in the Supreme Court, that it would be legal, it would be possible for a baker to put a sign in his window saying, quote, we don't bake cakes for gay weddings. Does the president agree that that would be okay?
The president certainly supports religious liberty, and that's something that he talked about during the campaign and has since upheld since taking office. I believe that would include that.
Kennedy actually, in response to that, said, well, that's an affront to the gay community. Oh, really?
And how about refusing to make them the cake in the first place? Is that an affront to the gay community?
And he said that businesses could start picking customers based on identity. Yes.
Yes. So he is both offended by discrimination against us and offended by any what he perceives as an expression of discrimination against religion. Here are the possibilities. One, he could side with the conservatives and decide for the baker's right to discriminate on the basis of purported religious principles, and we would lose.
With some tortured struggle to limit the scope of the decision, they keep
saying. Good luck with that.
Yes, because you're opening a Pandora's box here.
As you did with Hobby Lobby. Right. Or he could torture himself into overlooking what he thinks is the religious discrimination in the Civil Rights Commissioner's statement and decide with the liberals, in which case we would win. Or he could decide to try to cure the Civil Rights Commissioner's statement to make himself sleep better at night, even though he has misinterpreted her statement, and remand the case to the Civil Rights Commission or to the Colorado courts for a rehearing of this case
right.
in an attempt to clarify these issues. Meanwhile, of course, this is the court that just upheld Trump's discrimination against Muslims from certain countries by upholding the travel ban.
Yeah, where's the respect for religion? Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry. It's only Christian fundamentalism.
So we don't know where this is going to end up. It's a great mystery, and everybody is shaking their head.
And they don't have to, well, they don't ever have to issue the decision, but usually they don't. They save the big ones until June of 2018. Again, folks, it is so important, and it doesn't just have to do with LGBT rights. It has to do with all civil rights laws. And what I would remind you is that the separation of church and state is has been, pardon the expression, the salvation of the United States. It has let religion thrive and in many forms, and, you know, it has kept us from, you know, killing each other most of the time.
Right.
But before we leave the Supreme Court, we should also mention that they denied cert. They're not going to hear Houston's challenge to the Texas High Court ruling that cast doubt on whether the city was obligated to provide equal benefits to same-sex married couples. Now, Houston, same-sex married couples are receiving equal benefits now. There is a case that's working its way through the courts. There was a bad ruling by the Texas High Court in June. It's, you know, basically what the Supreme Court of the United States is saying, we're not ready for this. It hasn't even really been adjudicated under Obergefell by the trial court. So it's a procedural motion, essentially. It's not great. You know, it'd be great if the Supreme Court stepped in and said, stop this nonsense. But in terms of the way they handle cases, they're not ready for it. And they have ruled in our favor in a similar case in Arkansas already.
Right, right. But we should also footnote before we leave this something you said before we started taping. If they do remand the Masterpiece Cake Shop case back to a Colorado entity, and if we take longer to get to this Houston case, and who knows what other cases down the road, if Trump succeeds in putting another hard right conservative on the court to replace Kennedy or anybody else, we are really in trouble, because then we're just gone. They can do anything they want, right, just like the Republican Congress can do anything they want.
We will have little access to the federal court, the ultimate federal courts. The federal courts at the lower level, even with Reagan and Bush judges, has been decent to us.
Absolutely.
We've already heard from lawyers on our side say, well, we'll do our best to stay within state law on a lot of things and just get state court rulings, because what else are we going to do?
In the final analysis, The Advocate's Matt Baum wonders whether it's fair to say that art imitates cake.
What does creative mean exactly? Nobody's really sure. Is Carvel an art gallery? Is sandwich artist a literal term? Could Subway turn people away because sandwich making is an art form? Someone could claim to be a creative accountant. These legal arguments are creative. Colleges might be creative. An apartment building, a bank, a bus. You could make the case for any kind of business. If the cake shop wins this case, it could mean that any business could say, oh no, we're creative, and we don't have to follow the law. And if that happens, queer people would be denied a lot more than cake. And by the way, this isn't the first time someone's tried this. In the 1960s, a restaurant called Piggy Park made the case that they should be allowed to turn away black customers on the basis of the owner's religious belief that black people are biblically destined for slavery. The courts rejected his reasoning then, pointing out that while the owner is entitled to his private beliefs, a business that's open to the public can't violate the public's civil rights. 50 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled in that case that segregated restaurants should be against the law. Now we're about to find out if they still believe that to be true.
If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake.
It's not the first time Colorado and queer rights have met at the U.S. Supreme Court, and not the first time Justice Anthony Kennedy is the linchpin. I'm Lucia Chappell. Next time on This Way Out, we remember that May 1996 decision, when, by the way, Justice Kennedy ruled against bias.
Colorado, Colorado.
For the first time in the history of the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that gay and lesbian Americans are entitled to equal protection under the law.
It's important to understand that Amendment 2 was never about people. It was about conduct.
We're not trying to destroy the family. We want to have families and be accepted by our families.
Because of this ruling, there will be no logical or reasonable explanation as to why pedophilia, bestiality, bigamy, and polygamy cannot be denied to anybody that claims it.
We got a good decision, folks. It's going to have an impact for many, many years to come, and we all made it possible here in Colorado.
Sounds from our archives recall the May 1996 U.S. Supreme Court ruling on Colorado's discriminatory Amendment 2, next time on This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Wenzel Jones and Carol Myers, produced by Steve Fried, and from Public News Service's Eric Galatis, Gay USA's Andy Hammond, Ann Northrup, and The Advocate's Matt Baum. Eileen Barton performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentham, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible, especially during our Defeat the Noise year-end campaign at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For Associate Producer Richard Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WUML Lowell, Massachusetts, KKFI Kansas City, Missouri, 3MGB Malakuta, Victoria, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In dark times like these, it's easy to forget there have been other similarly dark times and that, nonetheless, people have fought and resisted and changed the world. They have done so with their actions, but also with their ideas and their artistic expression. Today we're going to feature just a few of the many people, known and unknown, who've stood up for social justice and the notion that another world is possible. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Malcolm X, anthropologist Margaret Mead, historian Howard Zinn, and the American Indian Movement leader Dennis Banks. But first, we'll begin with the voice of Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat to a white person on a bus in segregated Montgomery, Alabama, in the year 1955. I should say that all the excerpts that we're going to play in this hour come from this radio station, KPFA, or its sister Pacifica stations, put together in a collection called Voices That Change the World, which can be yours for a $200 pledge of support to KPFA. Here's Rosa Parks.
I left work on my way home December 1st, 1955, about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. I boarded the bus downtown in Montgomery on Coates Square. As the bus proceeded out of town, on the third stop, the white passengers had filled the front of the bus. When I got on the bus, the rear was filled with colored passengers, and they were beginning to stand. The seat I occupied was the first of the seats where the Negro passengers take as they on this route. The driver noted that the front of the bus was filled with white passengers and there would be two or three men standing. He looked back and asked that the seat where I had taken, along with three other persons, one in the seat with me and two across the aisle, was seated. He demanded the seats that we were occupying. The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused to do so. He then called the officers of the law. They came and placed me under arrest, and I was bailed out shortly after the arrest. And the trial was held December 5th on the next Monday, and the protest began from that day, and it is still continuing.
Well, Mrs. Parks, what in the world ever made you decide to be the person who, after all these years of Jim Crow and segregation, what made you at that particular moment decide you were going to keep that seat?
I felt that I was not being treated right, and that I had a right to retain the seat that I had taken as a passenger on the bus.
But, Mrs. Parks, you had been mistreated for many, many, many years. You've lived most of your life in Montgomery, Alabama. What made you decide at the first part of the month of December 1955 that you had had enough?
The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose.
And that is Rosa Parks being interviewed on KPFA about the decision that she took that is often credited for sparking the civil rights movement. And that is part of a collection that we are highlighting today called Voices That Change the World. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We're now going to turn to an excerpt from the same collection from the much more recent past, from 2007, at an event that was organized by KPFA's events coordinator, Bob Baldock. The year is 2007, and it was a debate on religion between Christopher Hitchens and Chris Hedges at a theater in Berkeley to a very packed house. I happen to be the moderator of that debate, so you'll hear my voice later on. But the first voice that we will hear is that of Christopher Hitchens, followed by Chris Hedges.
Shouldn't it be obvious to everyone in this room that let's not quarrel about how long the human species has been around, fully evolved? Some tens of thousands of years are generally agreed, perhaps longer. That God should have watched this species suffering, dying in childbirth, life expectancy of about 20 years, swept with plague, famine, misery, shame, mystery, dying in Brazil, dying in China, dying in Australia, countries not known to any of the writers of these testaments. Their animals not even known by it, and to have decided only a few thousand years ago, maybe it's time to intervene. Have a son of mine torn to shreds in a remote part of Bronze Age Palestine. Let the Chinese wait a few thousand years to find out that that's what happened. That should make them love each other. It's not to be believed. No serious person can believe it. Okay? Now, one way that you can prove it's not just man-made, but masculine-made, male-made, is the following. It's always, in every case, devoted to the subjugation of women. The Orthodox Jew has to begin the daily prayer. Thank God for not making me a woman or a goy. That's how much they think of women. Somebody has to buy retail, as was once said of the Goyish. Everybody knows what Islam says and mandates for women. Everybody knows also what St. Paul said about women. Everybody knows, even those who, probably there's some here who think maybe I have a Buddhist option here, has to notice that even Buddha is born from a slit in his mother's side. Anything but the filth and disgust of having to contemplate the female reproductive system. What could be more obviously man-made than this? And made in a barbaric period, even of the history of the male sex, it's plain as could be. The terror of menstrual blood, for example, the horror of it, the feeling of uncleanliness that attaches to everything female, that's before you start with every other manifestation of sexuality. Filthy, guilt-ridden, masochistic, horrible. Our emancipation from this is the condition of our emancipation under, it seems to me, any terms at all. And anybody who is willing to say, I still haven't had, I see, a challenge to my, or an answer to my challenge, that there's anything ethical about this belief, or that any ethical person couldn't say what any religious person has ever said, must begin with the absolutely obvious fact that half our species is condemned to subjecthood and disgust by the preachings of this Abrahamic, man-made, filthy propaganda. We must get over it. Emancipation, human emancipation, as with slavery, as with racism and creationism and all the other superstitions, human emancipation begins where this nonsense ends, and the time is short for us to find this out.
Well, that gets to the notion that somehow, if you abolish religion, which has been part of every human society since human society has been recorded, these dark impulses are somehow going to vanish. If torturers, killers, sadists, and tyrants don't wrap themselves in the cloak of religion, they'll wrap themselves in the cloak of something else. Fascism, communism, I mean, these are, you know, and I think as you correctly pointed out, bear many similarities to the kinds of ideological forms that we see within repressive religious institutions. The problem is not religion. The problem is the capacity we all have for evil, the capacity we all have for atrocity. And as long as we externalize evil, and that's, of course, what religious fundamentalists do, we can't guard against the ability and the seductiveness that all of us carry within ourselves. Great writers like Primo Levi struggled with this for most of their lives. You know when you're in a war zone that the line between the victim and the victimizer is always razor thin, and people will always find religious, ideological belief systems to justify evil. The problem is not religion. The problem is in the human heart.
Christopher Hitchens, you praise in your book the rationalist legacy of the Dutch Jewish philosopher Spinoza. Yet Spinoza was a pantheist. He believed that the universe and nature are inhabited by some kind of abstract divine force. Do you see any harm in this sort of spirituality without God?
Not really, I don't, because Spinoza, who I suppose you can still call Dutch Jewish, was in fact neither Dutch nor Jewish. He was excommunicated viciously by his synagogue and changed his name to avoid further identification. And his greatest emulator, Albert Einstein, followed him in saying that the whole idea of a personal God or a God who intervened was not just ridiculous, but detestable. Such a person is obviously not going to tell me that I can't have a ham sandwich, or not that I particularly wish to retire to a motel with Mr. Hedges after this is over, as if to make up our differences, as it were, rediscovers what was noted rather sapiently by Epicurus and Democritus well before any Abrahamic tyranny had imposed itself on us. How they knew this, I don't know. I'd love to know how they found it out, but that the world is made of atoms, and that if there are any gods, they're much too smart to involve ourselves in our sordid little quarrels. So, as someone who says, I feel spiritual, and I'm okay and you're okay, I find intensely boring. But if they're not going to try and tell me that their views must be taught in my children's school, or that their views must be legislated about stem cells or contraception, or that stultifying crap must not be taught in the schools under the name of intelligent design, I'll agree to avoid them, and they can go off and bore someone else. And though that's not the greatest lesson taught by Spinoza and Einstein, it's still a very important one.
And that is the voice of the late Christopher Hitchens, in a debate with Chris Hedges about religion, the title of that debate was Is God Great? And that was organized by KPFA. And it is included on this collection that we are offering during this hour. The collection is called Voices That Change the World. And it is a truly astounding compilation of recordings from the history of KPFA and its sister Pacifica stations, more than 1,200 hours of luminaries like Noam Chomsky and Miriam McCabe and June Jordan and the comedian George Carlin and the film critic Pauline Kael, who had a program here on KPFA before she moved on to become the critic for The New Yorker, and Stokely Carmichael, and Bertrand Russell, and Dylan Thomas, and Winona LaDuke, and Edward Said, and Molly Ivins, and Henry Miller, and Kathleen Cleaver, and debates including that between Linus Pauling and Edward Teller about nuclear weapons. So much is in this collection, more than 1,200 hours, and it is on a USB drive, so you just stick it into the side of your computer or your phone, and you can access this incredible trove of audio from the history, yes, the history of KPFA and Pacifica, but really the history of the left since the mid-20th century. And it is a phenomenal thank you gift, and I hope you will call right now and pick it up. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Again, 1-800-439-5732. And, of course, you can also pledge securely at kpfa.org. $200 gets you Voices That Change the World. We would, of course, welcome pledges that are less than that and pledges that are more. If you'd like to pledge at the $500 rate or the $1,000 rate, don't forget that your donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. So as the year comes to an end, it's a wonderful way to support an institution that has provided a home for so many of these maverick thinkers, these iconoclasts, and we'll do so into the future if you allow us to, if you keep us going. 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And I hope you will be moved to support us right now. This is the last day that Against the Grain comes to you in our regular time. This is the last week of our December fund drive. And a lot of money to raise every single hour, including this hour. We have a $2,500 goal, which is quite a bit of money that we need to be able to make. And I hope you will step forward and help us right now. 1-800-439-5732. The only thank you gift I can think of that is a better value than this collection, Voices That Change the World, is KPFA itself. And if you believe in KPFA, then please allow us to continue. 1-800-439-5732. We're now going to turn to a remarkable talk that I discovered within this collection. And I have to say it was very difficult choosing what to air today because there was so much to choose from, including a wonderful piece of Fidel Castro in Harlem in the 60s, just mobbed. And he's speaking through a translator, but it's a real gem listening to it. But one of the other things I discovered in this archive is the great anthropologist Margaret Mead speaking in the year 1967 on the subject of sexual freedom and cultural change. Let's take a listen.
What kind of adults are we going to need, and how will the styles that we set up in adolescence prepare them to be the kind of adults that... When I say we need, I'm not talking about the state or the government or Washington. I'm talking about Americans as a community in a world in which we are one part. And I could talk equally, what does the world need or what do we need? The we here means the whole human race living on this planet in intercommunication with each other, and what this the people on this planet need from the Americans who happen to be living in the richest spot on this planet and in many ways to be the most fortunate. Now, we have at present a kind of marriage which has been described as the all-purpose marriage. You expect, when you marry, your marriage partner to be totally satisfied. In bed, out of bed, early in the morning, late at night, in the car, on the mountains, as a parent, as a partner, skiing. And we have done something that no people have ever tried to do before, to take one other human being and make them into an absolutely all-purpose utility. Now, this is an exceedingly brittle form of marriage and very, very trying and very hard to live in. And when anything goes wrong, in bed or out of bed or skiing, people immediately think, I've made a mistake, I must get a divorce. He isn't what I thought he was. And no human being could be what anybody thought they were going to be under these circumstances. Now we can ask if we... The danger to these marriages, and tremendous danger, is this brittleness whenever the spouse fails in any respect. And it isn't only in sexual fidelity, but it is any other of 40 respects. I mean, he doesn't have quite the ethical sensitivity, or his views on politics are different, or he takes the toothpaste cap off a different way. I mean, it goes the whole range. Now we can ask what kind of relations in adolescence will fit into this kind of a marriage. And I think we can say that very rapid change of partners and breaking up immediately if there's any kind of disappointment is a very poor preparation for standing the kinds of disappointments that are bound to occur in marriages where we ask so much. So the kind of adolescent freedom, which means a month with one boy and 2 months with another and a third month with two others, and then they don't suit, going on from one piece of inexperienced experimentation to another, throwing one relationship after another aside as unsatisfactory, is an extraordinarily poor preparation. It is not a way of acquiring experience. It's a way of acquiring the practice of disappointment. And we have to face the very curious, I don't know whether one should say curious, but the fact that Americans are violently opposed to much association between the experienced and the inexperienced. We don't really like marriages where there's more than a 5-year difference. When a man of 40 marries a girl of 20, we shake our heads. And of course, if a woman of 40 married a man of 20, we don't bother to shake our heads. And we have very effectively cut off, partly because of our standards of monogamy, but even more because of our standards of peer relationships, any teaching in the United States from a person who knows anything about sex to someone who doesn't know anything about it.
And that is the anthropologist Margaret Mead speaking about American society and sexual practices in American society in San Francisco in 1967. I'm Sasha Lilly. What you just heard is an excerpt from an hour talk that she gave. And, you know, we're offering this collection on a USB drive, Voices That Change the World. And it is kind of an astounding collection because there are hour-long speech after hour-long speech in this. And we're just offering it to you for a $200 pledge of support. Often if we were to offer you an hour-long DVD, we might offer that to you at the $100 rate. But in fact, we're offering you a mind-boggling 1,200 hours plus of audio from the likes of Margaret Mead and Rosa Parks and Toni Morrison and Quentin Crisp and Audre Lorde and John Lennon and Gwendolyn Brooks. We are offering all of that just for a mere pledge of $200. And the number to call is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Or easy to remember is 1-800-HEY-KPFA. KPFA.org, of course, is another place you can pledge. And I struggled, I have to say, in deciding what to include in this collection because there was so much to choose from. And for me, it was a wonderful experience to just go into the vault, so to speak, and listen to all of this material, which, of course, you can do, too, if you pledge your support. There was a discussion with the French feminist and philosopher Simone de Beauvoir about her life, her childhood, her partnership with Jean-Paul Sartre. That's in there. It's just amazing material in this, and you will not be sorry if you pledge your support right now and pick it up. And there's a lot more that I want to play in this hour. I'm not sure if we'll be able to get to all the cuts that I've prepared. So I'm going to do something that I hope I won't regret. We have been handed a match from a listener in Oakland. Danny Allen has put up $200, which means he will double your donations dollar for dollar up to $200. And I'm going to, rather than just keep giving out the number, but I will do that right now, I want to go back to more material with the hope that you will call and pledge and make this challenge. So here is the number, 1-800-439-5732. If you aren't by your phone right now but will be soon, remember this as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Also go to kpfa.org. Danny will match your pledge right now if you call, and we're going to go to more audio from this incredible collection, The Voices That Changed the World, a $200 pledge of support to KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. What we turn to now is a famous speech, which happens to be here in this collection in its entirety, that Malcolm X gave on April 3rd, 1964, on the subject of the ballot or the bullet. He spoke in Cleveland, Ohio, to obviously a rapt audience. Let's take a listen to edited portions from that famous talk, The Ballot or the Bullet.
America is just as much a colonial power as England ever was. America is just as much a colonial power as France ever was. In fact, America is more so a colonial power than they, because she's a hypocritical colonial power behind it. What is 20th? What do you call second-class citizenship? Why, that's colonization. Second-class citizenship is nothing but 20th century slavery. How are you going to tell me you're a second-class citizen? They don't have second-class citizenship in any other government on this earth. They just have slaves and people who are free. Well, this country is a hypocrite. They try and make you think they set you free by calling you a second-class citizen. No, you're nothing but a 20th century slave. Just as it took nationalism to remove colonialism from Asia and Africa, it'll take black nationalism today to remove colonialism from the banks and the minds of 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country. It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody. America today finds herself in a unique situation. Historically, revolutions are bloody. Oh, yes, they are. They have never had a bloodless revolution or a nonviolent revolution. That don't happen even in Hollywood. You don't have a revolution in which you love your enemy. And you don't have a revolution in which you are begging the system of exploitation to integrate you into it. Revolutions overturn systems. Revolutions destroy systems. A revolution is bloody. But America is in a unique position. She's the only country in history in a position actually to become involved in a bloodless revolution. The Russian Revolution was bloody. Chinese Revolution was bloody. French Revolution was bloody. Cuban Revolution was bloody. And there was nothing more bloody than the American Revolution. But today, this country can become involved in a revolution that won't take bloodshed. All she's got to do is give the black man in this country everything that's doing. Everything. I hope that the white man can see this. Because if you don't see it, you're finished. If you don't see it, you're going to become involved in some action in which you don't have a chance. And we don't care anything about your atomic bomb. It's useless. So it means that the white man today is without a weapon. If you want some action, you got to come on down to earth. And there's more black people on earth than there are white people on earth. I only got a couple more minutes. The white man can never win another war on the ground. His days of war victory, his days of background victory are over. Can I prove it? Yes. Take all the action that's going on this earth right now that he's involved in. Tell me where he's winning. Nowhere. Up in French Indochina, those little peasants, rice growers, took on the might of the French army and ran all the Frenchmen. You remember Dien Bien Phu? No. The same thing happened in Algeria, in Africa. They didn't have anything but a rifle. The French had all these highly mechanized instruments of warfare, but they put some guerrilla action on them. And a white man can't fight a guerrilla warfare. Guerrilla action takes heart, takes nerve, and he doesn't have that. He's brave when he's got tanks. He's brave when he's got planes. He's brave when he's got bombs. He's brave when he's got a whole lot of company along with him.
Malcolm X speaking in Cleveland, Ohio, the famous ballot or the bullet speech in 1964. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and that speech is included in this collection, Voices That Changed the World, from the Pacifica Radio Archives. It's on a USB drive, and it's yours for a $200 pledge of support to KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, kpfa.org. There is so much in this collection that if I just listed off everything, probably the hour would be over, and I still wouldn't have mentioned everything. It includes, if you were listening yesterday, the Alan Watts 29-hour library collection. That can be found on this. There's over 1,200 hours of content, of audio, from the mid-20th century to the present, of social struggles, of political movements, of literary ferment, of artistic production. It is just a mind-boggling collection of material, and it is yours for a mere $200 pledge of support to KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. I printed out the list of everything that is on this, and actually it turned out to be 108 pages of just to even get it on an Excel spreadsheet. And so I'm not going to be telling you everything on it, but just simply in the collection, because there are many subsections within the collection, American Women Making History includes speeches or interviews with Germaine Greer, Yoko Ono is in here, Anais Nin, Shirley Chisholm, Adrienne Rich, Bella Abzug, Rita Mae Brown, Sylvia Plath, Audre Lorde, Jane Fonda, Sappho, obviously that's not an interview with her, presumably it's a reading of her work. That's just Alice Walker is in here. Betty Davis is in here. It is just mind-boggling. Bell Hooks is in here. Carmen McRae is in here. Sweet Honey in the Rock. Rosa Parks, we played a little bit from Rosa Parks. There is so much material in here. And so it's the kind of thing, I mean, what's so nice about it is it's not like you go to a library or an archive and you're presented with all of this information and within a short amount of time, you get a chance to listen to it. No. This is yours. You take it home and you listen to it whenever you feel like it. So you could dip into it. You could take it on a car trip. Let's say you're traveling during the holidays. It would be a wonderful time to pass away, to pass some time as you're traveling. But it's yours to keep. It's yours to share. It's yours to have in the same way KPFA is yours to have, as long as you do what you can to ensure that we keep going, because all of what the incredible recordings of the past, these would all have been lost. These would never have taken place if it weren't for KPFA and KPFA's sister stations being there to record it. And it gives me chills to think about a future where we don't have that, where there are not people there to give a forum to or record the talks, the ideas of the artists and visionaries and maverick thinkers of our time and the people creating movements, because movements come out of a place like this and out of the community of the airwaves here. It's amazing history, but it's really history that is about the present. It's something that actually in the clip we're going to hopefully have time for from Howard Zinn, he makes that point. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-439-5732. And I want to say thank you so much. We did make that match. We are grateful to everyone who has called and pledged so far, but we definitely need a whole bunch more of you to go to your phones and call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And let me remind you yet again that your donation is tax deductible. So now that the year is almost over, if you would like to make a substantial contribution to KPFA, and only you know what substantial means to you based on your budget, your income, whatever substantial is, we would be very, very grateful and you would get a tax deduction. So think about doing that if you can. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-HEY-KPFA or go to kpfa.org. There's so much more to present. Let me turn now to a talk that was given by Howard Zinn, the late historian who we associate history from below with in the United States, the author of A People's History of the United States, of course. In this talk, he talks about the importance of history and the uses of history for good and for ill. Let's take a listen to Howard Zinn.
You know, when I began to study history, it occurred to me, how undemocratic this history was, and how odd it was that here in this presumably democratic country, that our history was so undemocratic, that our history was a history of elites, and that the people were left out of the history. And in some way, there was some connection between an undemocratic history and an undemocratic society, because if you, generation after generation, reproduce an undemocratic history, a history that concentrates on what the great white men do at the top, then what you do is produce generation after generation a passive citizenry, a citizenry that expects that all the important decisions in society are going to be made by the President of the United States and the Congress and the Supreme Court, and that therefore the only thing that citizens have to do is to go to the polls every 2 or 4 years. The supreme act of citizenship is to go to the polls every 2 or 4 years, to go into that little booth and relieve yourself, something seemed to me fundamentally undemocratic about that. And then I remember, reading something by George Orwell, which epitomized that. Orwell said that whoever controls the past controls the future. And whoever controls the present controls the past. So whoever is in charge of our society can decide what our history will look like. And by deciding what our history will look like, they will decide our future. Well, that made history very important to me because it meant that history was not disengaged from society, that to create a more democratic history meant that you were at least playing some part in trying to create a more democratic society. So I found I had to read history on my own, and this is what most people find, that they learn more when they get out of class, right? You learn more when you start reading on your own. And so I started reading labor history, because I had been, at the age of 18, I was a member of the Industrial Union of Marine and Shipbuilding Workers of America, which we called UMSWA. You know, unions were never good at PR. So I was interested in labor history, and I got interested in, and that set me on the road to sort of learning about that history that I hadn't learned about in school, brought me into contact with all sorts of people and all sorts of events that were missing from the textbooks. There's nothing in the textbooks about Mother Jones. I encountered her when I, not in person. I mean, a lot of people are very suspicious when I say, things like that. They look at me and, yeah, I guess he did. But no, I encountered her when I read about, for the first time, about the Colorado coal strike of 1913-1914 and the Ludlow Massacre, all of that. Things are absolutely absent from my historical training. And Wright and I had gone right through the PhD in history. I mean, how much higher can you go than that? But nothing about Mother Jones. And nothing about the Colorado coal strike, and very little about the IWW. I was very interested in the fact that workers had to do what was done in Colorado and what was done in so many other places, what was done in Lawrence in 1912 and on the railroads again and again in the 1890s. They had to go out on strike in order to secure some modicum of improvement in their working conditions, because here was all this emphasis on laws passed by Congress, the Constitution of the United States, that bulwark of democracy, the thing which we celebrate and celebrate and celebrate. But the Constitution, the President, the Congress, the Supreme Court, they were not there when workers had to cut down their hours from 16 hours to 12 hours to 10 hours to 8 hours. There's nothing in the Constitution, nothing in the institutions of this presumably democratic country that enabled workers to do away with a 16-hour day. They had to do that on their own. Sure, there's the Bill of Rights, which gave certain, political rights and certain, all know about that, freedom of speech and press. Well, that's another story. A very complicated story. But nothing in the Constitution about economic rights. Well, it teaches you something about the value of institutions and the importance of the powers up there in Washington to see that when it comes to something as crucial as the most elementary biological needs of working people, of how hard they work, how long they work, what conditions they work under, what wages they get, that they're on their own. So the institutions of the country aren't there for them. They have to do it for themselves. That's a very, very important lesson in history.
And that is Howard Zinn speaking in 1992. I'm Sasha Lilly alongside C.S. Song, and we are here on the last day that KPFA, or that Against the Grain, comes to you in our regular time slot to raise money for this station and this program. And we are offering to you a collection that I can't praise highly enough. It is over 1,200 hours of fascinating, moving, inspirational, world-changing audio from the Pacifica Radio Archives, from KPFA and from its sister stations since the mid-20th century to the present. And it can be yours for your pledge of $200 by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can also go to kpfa.org. You'll find it on a USB drive that you can just niftily plug into your computer, and there you have it at your fingertips for as long as you want. It belongs to you, and you will be able to listen to it whenever you want, on the go or late at night if you're wanting to be inspired or moved or just reflect on the tumultuous history of the last 70 years. So much of it is captured in this collection. And it's not just, it is a story of struggles. But what I find so valuable is it's the story of resistance, and it's a reminder that people have always fought back and that people have always struggled, even in the darkest times, to change the world. And often they're successful. And what's so interesting is when you do look back at social movements, that you can see that people may have struggled for years and years and years in the wilderness without anything changing, and then all of a sudden something does. This history is captured in this collection, yours for $200 pledge by calling 1-800-439-5732. And in the clip we just heard, Howard Zinn talks about the paramount importance of knowing history, but also making sure that history, that the telling of history is, he argues, an essentially political act. It's a question of what is included and what is left out. And when the history of struggle is left out, then it completely narrows the horizons of the present. He quotes Orwell saying, "Who controls the present controls the past." Right? That's kind of logical, that the way that the history of the past is told. And then who controls the past controls the future, because it shapes our understanding of what, of the possible. And I would say KPFA is all about broadening the horizons of the possible. And this history absolutely does that. It's just something that we should all, I think, dive into, to whatever degree we feel like we want to, because as I say, once you get the drive, it's not like you've gone to an archive and now is the moment you have to listen to it all or you're going to miss out. You can listen to this over months, over weeks, over years, whatever you choose. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And I'd like to encourage those of you who can to think about giving even at the higher than $200 rate, maybe at the $500 rate or the $1,000 rate, because your donation is tax deductible and the year is almost over. It's a wonderful thing to do. And if you listen to us when we were playing excerpts from The Untold History of the United States, that's the 12-hour documentary history about the rise of the national security state in the United States and U.S. Empire, directed by Oliver Stone. We're throwing that in today. So if you'd like to get the collection Voices That Changed the World and add in the boxed DVD set of this 12-hour, 12-documentary series, The Untold History of the United States, you can do so for $360. And that is a wonderful way to support us. But however you do it, now is the time. 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And C.S., just to add to the urgency of the moment, we've also been handed a match a match by two listeners, James Webb in San Jose and Susan Murray in Berkeley, who collectively have put up $500. So what they've said, in effect, is from now to the top of the hour, they will match you dollar for dollar. They are challenging you to pledge right now in the less than 7 minutes that we have before the hour is over. But collectively, listeners have to rise to the challenge or they may consider taking their money back. So now is the time to call and pledge. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA.
Oh, and I like the combo pack. I like the combo pack, which is talk about history, talk about alternative history, the Voices That Changed the World compilation, plus the Untold History of the United States, the DVD of all those documentaries. For it comes out to $60 a month over 6 months if you'd like to pay it that way. And no, you don't have to pay all your installments before you get those amazing thank you gifts coming your way. If you want Voices That Change the World alone, that's a $200 pledge, as Sasha mentioned, comes out to $33 a month over 6 months, and your dollars are doubled. What a great time to call. As Sasha has said, you know, the last time that we come to you during our regular time slot during this fund drive, it's over on Friday. Today is Wednesday. It's over on Friday. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Alan Watts, for those of you who listened yesterday, as Sasha's mentioned, Alan Watts is also in this compilation, Voices That Change the World, in abundance. I think it's something like 30, 35, 38 plus hours of Alan Watts. So if you're a fan of Alan Watts, you can get him in addition to all the amazing voices you heard today, as well as, oh my gosh, where do we start, right? Muhammad Ali and Molly Ivins and Aldous Huxley and Jim Hightower and Fannie Lou Hamer and Cornel West and Karen Armstrong and Audre Lorde and Rachel Carson and Thich Nhat Hanh and Dolores Huerta and Frank Zappa and Carlos Castaneda and audiobooks. We have, you know, there are a number of audiobooks here, Grammy Restored Recordings, Radio Arts, the Free Speech Movement, Religious Studies, Dr. Michio Kaku. There is so much to gorge yourself with. I mean, it's really kind of an amazing thing. It is a rich tapestry of the history of Pacifica Radio. And Howard Zinn, you heard talking about how history comes to us from on high. So many filters, so many choices, so many censors. Yes, in this country, as far as what we learn about our history, and you can get this amazing collection to really blow your mind about the alternative history, the radical history, the progressive history, the groundbreaking history of dissent in this country. Who wouldn't want to not only share that with themselves, but share that with young people, share that with a library, share that with a school? And your dollars, as Sasha has mentioned, are doubled, but only until the end of this hour. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can donate online at kpfa.org. Choose any thank you gift you like. You can call in and ask for any thank you gift you like. But give us a call. Let us know you're there. Let us know you support Against the Grain and what we do. 1-800-439-5732.
And I'd like to thank a few people who have called and pledged. Deborah Marks in El Cerrito, thank you so much. Chuck Kottner in Mill Valley, we want to thank you. Haley Keltner in Oakland, thank you so much. Christine Bell in Fairfax, thank you. And Joni Watts in Porta La Valley. They all called 1-800-439-5732. And we have several people who've pledged online at kpfa.org. But now we really are turning to you because we have a $500 challenge on the line. And, you know, every hour we have a goal that we have to make. And, you know, we operate here on a shoestring. So these goals are really serious. If we don't make the money in every hour that we need to make to stay healthy, that we cut into our ability to bring you the kind of programming at the caliber you expect here on the station. And we really hope that you will hear our appeal right now and come through for us. We've got 2.5 minutes left. So your call is really crucial right now because you can make or break this challenge of $500. We have to make the whole thing or offer it back to James and Susan, and we really don't want to do that. So please, please come forward to us right now, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to play an edited excerpt from Dennis Banks, one of the leaders and founders of the American Indian Movement, who died in October. But if you subscribe for the collection, that will be there amongst so much other material. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And, of course, the tax deduction is a fantastic thing to remember. And if you can pledge at a higher level, you want to throw in the DVD 12-hour documentary series, The Untold History of the United States. You can do so. Get the Voices That Changed the World along with it for a $360 pledge. Boy, would you be set for viewing and listening for a while. You'd be really, really set. I don't think you'd regret it at all. And these things make fantastic gifts as well. Although you would not get them in time, obviously, the holidays are just straight around the corner. But, you know, if you have birthdays in the new year that you want to give someone a gift, a wonderful thing to give. And if you can give it the $1,000 rate right now, you know, we're in the waning days of this fund drive, and we appreciate big donations.
We'll take it.
And we'll take small ones. We really appreciate it all. So this is a time, I guess, I'm appealing for people who've been thinking, yes, I support KPFA, I should do it. I know it'll make me feel really good. Please do it right now. That's my appeal. And we've got less than 60 seconds left to go. We have $500 on the line, and I don't yet know how close we are to making that. So won't you be the person who puts us over the top in the next 30 seconds? Call up and let us know. Going online is also a great way to make the match. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. Be part of this history. Be part of this incredible history by sustaining an institution that is unique. If we weren't around to do this, all of these voices would be lost. I mean, it's a tragic thing to think about, and it's tragic to think that's possible in the future. 1-800-439-5732. Phone room says we made the match.
Yay, thank you so much.
Thank you all so much.